Okay. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, October 26, 2022. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028 and will offer a live public comment period during the business section of our meeting, as well as public comment during our budget hearing. You may join us live on our Microsoft Teams meeting through our website at www.jeffersonhealthcare.org. Select About Us, then Hospital Commission, and scroll down to the links. You may also join audio only at 509-598-2842 and enter ID number 702-065-698#. Session is being officially audio recorded and time shown on the agendas are estimate only. All commissioners are present. And the first order of business is to approve the agenda. I have a correction in that there is no executive session today. So with that, is there a move to approve the amended agenda?
So move.
Is there a second?
Second. Second.
Is there any discussion? Thank you. All right. All in favor, raise your hand, please. Okay, thank you. That's unanimous. And we will go on. So today we have a construction plan overview. This is going to be really great, interesting. And so, Mike, I'm going to turn the meeting over to you for doing the introductions and looking forward to this.
So, you bet.
Thank you.
Well, gosh, for now, for about the last, I don't know, 6 months. I'm trying to think back to when we sort of started those board meetings focused on the replacement and expansion project. I have been giving you updates on sort of the status of this project, and I think the big challenge and the design team can appreciate this from me because they've heard it on several occasions, is that we've got 5x worth of needs for our community and something less than 5x of resources to meet those needs. So the challenge has really been, how do we create as much program, a forward-thinking program for our community, and do it in the most cost-effective way? And before I introduce the players and the presentation, I just want to give a plug not only to Abbott and ZGF and OAC, but also to this progressive design build methodology, where, unlike any other project that we've done in the past, we have regular meetings with the design team and the general contractor, the mechanical and electrical and plumbing engineers, and the hospital, and work through our goals and our ideas and our hopes and aspirations with everybody on the same side of the table. So we would not have been able to get as much program into what we're about to show you were it not for that process. It's a remarkable breath of fresh air when everybody is aimed at the same goal, the same target, and really focused on delivering the most for our community. So along the way, we've made some decisions that I think have helped deliver on more program, more services, where I'm not sure we would have uncovered that the traditional way. Secondly, the team I'm going to introduce to you from the architect firm ZGF, Jim Harmon and Craig Rizzo, and from Abbott Contractors, I think Brad and Shelley and I thought Joshua Sykes. I think Josh is on the line, and then our OAC Greg Andrews. They've just been terrific to work with, and great direction, great expertise, great patience with an organization and a leadership team that that sometimes hopes and aspirations are a little bit larger than engineering reality or affordability would dictate. But it's been a great process of explaining what our options are, explaining the advantages and disadvantages, and helping us work through some tough decisions that if you had more money than you needed, you wouldn't have to make. But it's been a great process thus far, and I think it's because of the progressive design build methodology, but also because of the folks that you'll be hearing from tonight or this afternoon. So when I first spoke with them, I thought, you know what, I wanted to give an update to the board at the October board meeting. And initially, we thought that that would be during my administrative presentation. But during the course of the last few times they were in front of us, I saw what I thought would constitute more than 10 or 15 minutes of presentation. So I thought to myself, well, maybe I'll just give them the whole education part of the meeting, and they can really take the board through where we're at with elevations and exteriors, and to some extent blueprints and plan layouts. And that was a great idea, were it not for I didn't mention it to them that their time period had gone from 15 to 20 minutes to something longer. So when we communicated that to them in their typical style, they rallied and patched together, I think, all of the important documents and basically a snapshot of where we are at today with respect to this project. And I think we're getting closer. I know we're getting closer with building layout. I know we're getting closer with service layout within the building. We're still working on some elevation design features. How we can give the new building, a distinct flavor, but also a real sense for a campus and blending into the ESSB. And maybe some other logistic details about patient flow and visitor flow and wayfinding. But I can tell you that what we're going to show you today is by far closer to the finish line than we've ever been. So I think that there will be lots of time at the end for questions. When I turn it over to Jim and Craig, if questions during the middle of your presentation work well for you, you might mention that to the board. But the goal is for you to, at the end of this, for you to have a real good feel about where we're at, any questions you may have answered, any additional information you need, let us know. Just sort of a good overview of where we're at right now. So I will go ahead and turn it over to Jim Harmon and Craig Rizzo, two of the key architects from ZGF, and ask them to begin. And I think you're on mute.
Yes, Jim. I was. Okay. How many times I've heard that over the last 3 years? I don't know. So I just want to give a few remarks, and then Craig's going to actually walk through most of everything. As Mike said, this is really a snapshot in time of where we are. We've been working on the project for a little over 6 months. A lot of it had to do with was refining the scope in terms of, originally it was a project that this big, and then it got a little bit smaller. And so working through all those and trying to get the right pieces into a smaller project has been what we've really been focusing on for most of the last 6 months. So first slide, really, Mike went through this. This is actually pictures, so you can see who he was talking about. Brent is not on the call. Greg, I believe, is on the call. He's the person we've been working with day to day at OAC. Brannon is with Abbott, and he's the director of pre-construction. He's the guy that is figuring out how much we can afford to build. And Josh is sort of my counterpart at Abbott. He's the project manager, the project exec for Abbott. I'm the PM, so that means that I get to talk to Mike a lot and convey that information that he's telling me, like, you need to produce a presentation for the board meeting. And Craig is the design lead. So Craig will be talking through most of this. Craig, can you go to the next one, which basically has the agenda? So we already did the introductions. We'll do a little bit of a project overview, then look at the site issues that are coming up because it's a tight site and there's a lot of parking that's associated with the medical office building portion of this that we've been challenged to try and find a way to put on the site in an economical fashion. We'll look through the planning that we've done to date and talk about the way we're trying to make sure that we're creating a project that flows from the 1999 building, connects to the 1988 building, to the ESSB, and is really merges all of the things that are going into the new project. So it's very easy for patients to find their place where they're going. We'll talk about materials that are used on the ESSB and on the 1995 building and how we're trying to take from that information and the way that appearance and create an integrated campus so we don't have a whole series of different looking buildings. And that's one of the things that we're really working on right now, both interior and exterior. We don't have a lot of interior development at the moment in terms of interior design. But we have been working on that, and we'll be talking about that later in the process. And then it's really to look through where we are in terms of the development of the exterior and how that works with the ESSB and the 1995 building and views around the site. And then there's just a brief overview of where we are with the budget. And then we'll talk a little bit about next steps and where we are in the process. Just before I stop yapping here, there's just a couple things that I want to emphasize. And one is that one of the unique things about your facility is that it's got the courtyard that's in the middle of it and the dining and the kitchen area with Chef Aaron Stark is really seen as a major community amenity. And what we've tried to do is recognize that and capture that as part of the project going ahead. So you'll see something about how we've done that as we look at it. And again, I just want to emphasize that it's we're at a snapshot in time, and we're working to make sure that the project looks like a whole as opposed to a series of multiple buildings that are kind of all sort of glued together. So with that, I'm going to stop talking and turn it over to Craig, unless there's any questions.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Craig Rizzo with ZGF. Happy to be here and happy to be a part of this project. As Mike said, we've gotten to know each other quite a bit, going back and forth and meeting online as best as we can with the team, a fully integrated team. We talk daily multiple times, and it's been really a great experience. So I'm going to take you through about 30 slides or so and kind of give you an overview and just try to give you a good sense of where we are, as Jim had mentioned, in the SD, the schematic design process stage of where we're at currently. So please feel free to ask any questions as we go forward, and I'll be happy to try to address them or other folks on the team. Okay, let's see. Honestly, trying to advance the slide. So there we go. Okay, here's an aerial shot of the campus. On the left, the most recent construction, the ESSB, the 1988, which is to the north, and the 1995, which is between the building and the water, off to the east. And as Jim mentioned, the courtyard in the center, which my first visitation to the hospital, to your campus, was one of the highlights for me to kind of walk by there and see the natural light coming in there. So finding that opportunity to rethink that and to plan that as we kind of build onto the campus has been a great thing to think about. So that pink portion is the 1965, the oldest portion of the campus now there, and that will be removed. That's a significant chunk. It takes out major circulation with the image on the right with the blue dashed line, which is the most used thoroughfare going through the campus connecting across. The orange arrow up at the top of that drawing on the right is more of the staff functions. When we take that pink portion out, that's really kind of disconnecting the hospital. So there's a challenge day one of how do we kind of maintain that crucial connection for the facility during the interim. And that's one of the charges with designing this project, as well as reconnecting that when you start to backfill, infill, and add the new building components. So a great challenge. Now, when we look at this and how we build, we have to think about the context. We're taking out that, extracting that older portion, and we're going to build back in. And the program is pretty diverse. There's some major components. One, it's the dietary that wants to be the heart and the center to feed and provide for the campus, but more patient-faced programs that we're looking at and how to kind of utilize those and bring them out to the front so that they're ease of wayfinding and easily accessible. But also some components that are part of the organization, the operations that we also want to tuck back. So there's that give and play of trying to set up and program the layout, which we'll look at when we get to the plans. But in thinking about the massing, we're thinking about this in terms of a one-level infill and a two-level. And you'll see that more on as we get into the presentation of what that build is. But that gives you a sense, a little sketch of what the massing is going to evolve into, and we'll talk about why. Now, because you have these adjacent buildings, being the 1995 and the ESSB, they both have windows facing into each other. So considering a build that is multi-story in between those, can be done, but it's challenging. The biggest challenge is the ESSB has patient rooms, and patient rooms require by code access to daylight. So that means it impacts the buildable component that could be between the two buildings. So that caused challenges, as well as some code issues in regards to building setback. So it became clear early on that in order to build higher, we had to pull that forward so that we could still accommodate those views and those connections. The other challenge we had is with floor-to-floor heights between the two buildings. There are different levels, so when thinking about how to make those connections in the future, or if we were to design those connections, that would have to be considered. So currently, with that one-level infill, there is no second-story connection between the ESSB and the 1995. All components and access will be at grade at level one to get into those buildings. Okay. So as we start looking at the site, Jim mentioned many challenges. The two images are some great aerials that were done for this project to give a good sense of the site and what you have there on your campus. So with all kind of architectural projects, the biggest challenge is parking. Parking is always something that comes up, and how to accommodate and how to do that in creative ways. As we look at the drawing on the right, you can see in gray, the darker gray, that's the two level, is that two level structure that I mentioned. The one level is the component that's infilling in between the existing campus. And with that program, the city requires so many parking for how that program is determined. So once we understand the program, we can apply that metric and understand what the parking is. Now, the big driver for this is going to be obviously the clinical uses. And so there's a big component for parking. And parking tends to want to be as close as it can to the front entry. So as we infill the building in between where the old 1965 used to be, it allows for parking to the south, as well as parking to the east, because the need for parking is greater than you currently have on your campus. So with that, we're accommodating about 120 stalls for this new build, and that will blend in with the parking that you have. So you'll increase your capacity greatly by having the parking to the south, but also by going to the east. Going to the east, that pink line indicates that the grade, the topography there, drops about 45 feet from the edge of the building all the way down to the adjacent street. And so how do we do that? And how do you do that economically? So the team has been working to level off that parking best we can. We'll come back in and we'll fill and we'll build retaining walls. The team's been looking at how to do so and how high those can be, as well as pitching the surface lot so that we can accommodate a level surface that staff and families can safely arrive to get to the front door. And so we've been looking at different systems to do that. The south parking lot, south of the building component, where you see the 53 stalls, that's going to provide adjacent parking for families to come and drop off. There's a drop off there, and they'll come off of 7th Street, make their way into the campus and park there. And if not, they can drop off and go back to the east and park there. So there'll be a pedestrian path that will allow east parking to get to the front door. And I can talk about that a little bit more in the next slide. But you can see in those two images, the hillside that's there, the topography change, a beautiful campus that has land that we need to manage in the project. And as I mentioned, these are some of the outlining the access. So the blue lines indicate car travel. So you can come off 7th, drive into the ESSB parking, turn right, go into the drop-off sequence, find parking there. And if not, you could pull out back onto 7th and make your way to the eastern lot. And that pink line depicts a pedestrian path for access, because we're going to provide a new door on the south side of that two-story structure, the clinic entry. So the hospital will have three main entries. You'll have the ESSB entry, you'll have the clinic entry, and currently the 1995 entry, which is on the east side, as well as the ED entry and the ambulance on the north side. So. Any questions? You following okay?
No.
Okay, great.
I have one question, and I don't know how important it is, maybe not at this point, but there was a small grotto where it looks like there is a parking place now, parking lot. Is there a way that we can retain any semblance of that if it has to be moved or anything? Just a question.
The short answer, Jill, is no.
Okay.
We went to great lengths and great expense to redirect lines out of the way of the grotto during the ESSB project. It's my recommendation that because of where it's placed and the activity that's going around it, stature on the campus. I mean, I don't really think it's it may have had meaning to the original operators of the hospital, but I think less meaning to us. It's my recommendation that it be removed and relocated if someone wishes to do that, but that we don't build around it.
Okay, I could see that. Okay, thank you.
I would just like to make a comment. I'm probably you are aware, but what is now the dining area in the 65 building was actually part of that little patio, the little open space. It was all one big open space back in when I came here in 82. Mm-hmm. And then in 87, 88, when the ED was rebuilt, it was then sequestered and used as a dining area, you know, closed in.
Right.
So I hope there'll be some open space. And a thought comes to mind, and I know Mike's going to kill me, for any potential dining on the roof of the single-story building that would be, I think, enjoyed by staff and the public alike.
Yeah, I know the courtyard space is quite impressive. And that was one of the first things I was looking at. I saw that it had increased in the volume inside to get clear story lighting, just to bring more natural light in there, which I think was a great move to kind of make that big. We're going to make it larger, and you'll see it in coming plans. And you can see it in this one, actually. It's actually a little larger, almost twice the size or so, or more than twice the size. We will have outdoor seating area and dining area, and that's something that Chef Aaron Stark has been very interested in, as well as the team. We're very pleased to kind of be working on this space, and we'll have dining, and we're actually designed into covered portions of that area. They'll be covered as well, and we're working with the landscape design to kind of come up with a multiple use function for that, because there's a lot of great things that you can do with it for lush landscape, as a focal point for wayfinding, as you're inside seeing that, as well as providing the seating areas. I know Chef Aaron likes to have outdoor events, so things like that to accommodate. Seating on the roof is a lot more difficult, because then you need an elevator and provide the necessary egress access to it, as well as, you know, the mechanical functions up there. So that's a lot more difficult of a task, and one that I don't think we can accommodate for this. So, but having a kind of larger space and providing that opportunity is something that we are targeting.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the comment.
We asked about it too, and several times, and it's
Mr. Naysayer said, yeah, no, as Craig said, we get a challenge with that. I think one of the other things to point out, though, Craig, is there's that outdoor terrace that's over there sort of at the south end of the 1995 building, which I think we're still able to provide access to that as well, right? So it's kind of in this corner over here.
Yes, that's correct.
So we're trying to accommodate as much of that as possible. But as Craig said, putting dining on the roof of the one-story section of the infill is going to be a real challenge.
Thank you.
Now, as we're looking at the site, too, I want to draw attention to the service yard. That is also, I mentioned the dietary being the heart of the campus, but I think we all know, too, the service yard is as well, because that's where everything's coming in and out of the hospital. There'll be more activity there. Some other elements that we're working hard to minimize, as we know that it's a confined space already. And as I mentioned, trucks come in and out of there daily for their deliveries and takeaways. So trying to accommodate that, we're working with the team right now to work on that. So there'll be some evolution in that in presentations to come.
And if I may add, I think that some of the produce and other trucks that service the dietary area, they come in and the ESSB parking lot and offload to what is now the dietary through the little alleyway there. So I don't know whether that's a consideration for you guys.
So
it is. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, we did have a conversation with Chef Aaron and Aaron Vallet about that. And I think the current thinking is that that function, which now happens in the ESSB parking lot, is going to move up to where we have, well, this says ambulance entrance, but that's actually the urgent care entrance, where that is likely to come down the corridor and go directly into the kitchen, because the kitchen is located about 20 feet north of where that courtyard is. So there's dining directly to the north of the courtyard, and then the kitchen and servery area is to the north of that. So it's got it'll have a straight shot in from the north to get into that area.
Good. So where just below the ambulance red mark, that would be where the kitchen would be situated now?
Craig, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, the kitchen will be north of, see the green courtyard in the center?
Yeah.
It'll be north of that will be the dining and then the kitchen. So it'll be back in that area.
Yeah, they're much better. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of talk about, you know, the site flows and, you know, hospital has multiple portals and how do you access them? And all that comes into play when we start planning.
Okay. Yeah. But the main entrance, I assume, will still be the ESSB entry with where registration is.
That's correct. And then there'll be a second entry for the clinic for accessing surgery or accessing the clinics on the second floor.
Yeah, great. Because back in when 95 building was built, we had an entrance off of Sheridan, and it became very confusing to have the main entrance at the rear.
Yeah.
It's considered the rear of the building, the east side. So thank you.
And then this graphic just shows, because you're probably thinking, how much of that space does it take on the site? This is a superimposed 1965 building, shows the courtyard. You can see the new courtyard just to the right of that in kind of a light green, just to give you a sense of where it sits on the property.
And it's bigger.
It's bigger, yeah. Thank you.
So here's the planning. So Marie, this should answer some of your questions. A lot of evolution, as Mike had said. We had come out there several times just kind of rethinking and repackaging and re-strategizing how this all works. And so let's, you know, the blue in this diagram indicates all kind of public access and for connectivity. The courtyard is in the center, which is white, and I mentioned it's being larger. The very top of the program infill, the kind of ochre, we've got facilities, biomed, EVS, and then nursing admin to the right in the lavender, which is back by that existing corridor today, which is that crucial connection point from imaging to the ED. Then just south of that is the dietary component. So that's going to be the kitchen, storage, tri-storage, food prep, and all that. And then just south of that in the drawing, you can start to see those tables and chairs. That's going to be the servery and dining component. And so we're still working right now with the kitchen designer as well as Chef Stark to kind of design that space. So we're just starting that process. To the left component, you see the MRI suite. There's an added program there to add an MRI, and we're keeping that close to imaging and also close to the front door for ESSB to make that simple and easy for coming in for walk-ins and outpatient services for that.
So,
and then go ahead.
If I can ask a question here, because if we have to replace the MRI, how are we going to get it in the building or get the old one out and the new one in?
That's a great question. Yeah.
So the MRI access will either it's, and we actually reviewed this with, I can't remember the MRI vendor, but we talked about it'll come down that same corridor where the food comes down. So it's that corridor that's just to the west of where the new development is. So up right, of course, you can't see my cursor, but it comes down the same corridor. And these two rooms that are in yellow that are directly east of the green room, which is the MRI room itself. One of them is the MRI equipment room, and the other is an equipment storage room. So the equipment storage room is designed so that we can pull out the wall to the corridor, and we can pull out the wall between the equipment storage room and the MRI and bring the MRI in and out through there. So it's really, it's a straight down and then a one turn into there.
And hopefully they're not going to get any bigger in days to come, 10, 20 years.
Well, right now, since it's a 1.5T, I think is what we're talking about, and up to a 3T, we can get it through an 8x8 corridor. And that's what we've got clearance for there. If we, you know, if we go to a 7T, then that's a whole different thing. But right now, that's sort of the standard of care. In most places is a maximum of a 3T.
Thank you.
Great. And so just moving south on the plan, you can see the radiation oncology with the linear accelerators being proposed on the left side. That's the big vault with the big thick walls around it, the green space. We've got an OBGYN clinic, 6 exam rooms. And then coming down into that is the surgery, the outpatient surgery department is that whole block down there. So you can see right in the center, those two big green spaces, those are the OR suites. The gray area is actually for future expansion, so considering that. And then the PACU, the pre and post and surgery arrival is just to the south of that. So that entry point at the south west end of the campus, just north of the parking there, is your specialty clinic access. So your secondary entry portal into the hospital, And when you go in there, there's elevators, the dark blue, to go up to the second floor to access the clinics. And you know, there's a stairway there, but just connecting, you can see all that light blue connecting back to the campus.
And the expansion space for the surgery center has the ability to have a third OR built out in the future, as well as sterile processing.
And my next question, sorry to hog this deal, but where's the storage? As a nurse, retired nurse, I want to know where the storage is for all the equipment for the OR.
So that yellow area behind the two green rooms is a clean core, so it's quite large. It's about 15 feet wide by about 60 feet long. And then there's other equipment storage, which is in these gold areas, which are around it. So we've accommodated as much equipment storage. I don't know what the exact square footage is right now, but that's what we're trying to accommodate. Yeah.
Great. Okay. So then we have this diagram that really shows that kind of in the center drawing is that light blue is the kind of circulatory path for public. We've got the ESSB entry in the circle with the pink. You've got the surgical specialty clinic center down at the south that we were just talking about, also in pink. And then when you come to the kind of center of the campus, just near the courtyard to the lower left, you come to a decision point. So hopefully improving wayfinding by providing this larger courtyard that's going to allow natural light to come in and really taking that as an oasis, as you're kind of in between these four buildings, as they all come together and this juncture is offering that space, the dietary component, the heart, as we call it, the oasis of the campus where it's going to bring natural light in and provide that kind of wayfinding monument for, you know, more intuitive finding your way through the hospital. So, and then making that connection back to imaging, that's super important. That's been a conversation that we've had throughout the project, is how to get folks from the front door of the ESSB back to the imaging department. And so trying to increase that wayfinding and making it an easier process to get back to. So,
great.
And of course, you know, with the interior shots in the upper right, using that as kind of a design parameter for blending and keeping a cohesive design throughout. So taking points for that. Okay, we've been studying in models as well. That's the image on the left. We come to meet with the team and bring models for showing how we think this is coming together. And this is the second floor, a smaller floor plate, but one that has, you know, 40 exam rooms, so a lot of clinic space. The purple and the orange on the right is staff and support providers. So they'll have views out to the west. The blue area is the kind of assemblage for the lobby and waiting area. They'll have views out to the south, which are wonderful views, and then, you know, views out to the west as well. Okay. And then this is the circulation, just a quick path of understanding how folks come in. They go down the corridor on the left and then into each specialty clinic.
Really, now, really exciting.
Expansion, I mentioned early on, with that parking lot to the south, it offers us a pad for adding on more space potentially. So expanding clinics just gives you a quick idea of what that plan might look like. And I think given the height requirements, you can build, I think, three levels there. So you could get a good bunch of, this is a hypothetical condition, but if you were to add clinics, it could look like this.
And now, and just a note here, you'll see that the surgical area in this plan is different than the previous one. So it just shows that we've been working through all different sorts of arrangements for how to put surgery in that six exam room clinic in there over the last couple months.
Great. Thank you for that, Jim.
And also, I think this points out that we really are trying to look 10 to 15 years down the road. And, you know, our mantra is we want to avoid the next group of hospital administrator building designers from asking the question, just what the hell were they thinking, or why weren't they thinking about the next project? So I think when we were really trying to plot out where's the most sensible place for additional specialty clinic exam rooms, which will probably be a need in the next 5 to 10 years, certainly closer to all of the diagnostic equipment and instrumentation of the hospital is best. And we think that would be a great pad. And then, of course, we have the pad further to the south on the Orchard lot. But I just wanted to reinforce the notion that everybody is truly trying to think about the next project and making it easier for the next group of folks who grapple with this.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize, yeah, Mike's really kind of pushed us to do that. And that corridor that you see, the blue line that extends from the hospital near the courtyard all the way down will continue. And when I go to the next slide, too, for connecting the clinics as well, has been a strong kind of design driver as we've been developing the schemes. So. And then, of course, as I mentioned, parking is always challenged by the program. There'll be an increase of parking need as well. Clinics, exam rooms are a big driver for the more quantity of exam rooms, the more parking you need. So by that time, you'll need to do a significant investment on the site for developing, a parking structure. And what does that look like? And because you have the topography, there's some room there to minimize the impact to the views, but certainly something that you'll need to take on as well. I've indicated a drop-off in the center there. There might be a new front door at that point, because if you have more parking on the east side, they need to get into the clinic space, and that will be a new a connection point. So something to think about for the future, for sure.
The challenge will be once we get past this stage, as Craig is saying, is that we're probably going to exceed the ability to put all of the parking on grade on the site. And so That's going to be a challenge. Do we do a structure? Do we reach to the south and try and put parking down there? Or is there another solution that we came up with?
Right.
When I say we, I really mean you, because I don't assume that we're going to get to do that. But
so now we'll get into where we are with the kind of studies of massing and architecture. The existing campus, looking at the ESSB, has a low use of brick and glass, and a very dark, almost black brick and glass. And that's a pretty good datum line for the ESSB building, whereas the whole, you can see in the other images, it wraps around entirely on the lower level. When you lift up to the second and third levels, you get the brown tone, warmer toned brick, as well as glass with playful use of like a wood look panel or wood panelization. There is a kind of metal banding that stitches it all together and holds it together. And then at the entry point, you get this this element of expression that has a warmer tone. In this case, it's precast concrete and glass and metal. And these are references we're taking as we look at the exterior. Also, being mindful of budget, this building is a different exterior system or structure system than we're looking at. You heard Mike mention that we've been really trying to focus on providing as much program we can and thinking strategically on how to kind of put this together. There's some more images looking at the SSB, so taking note of what's there. I even have some images of the 1995, which was EFIS and metal panel and glass. And so as we're looking at the structure, we've been working with the design team coming up with, well, how do you kind of approach something in a challenge market to be efficient in how you use materials and sequencing and construction? And so we're looking at a concrete precast tilt-up system, which these images on the left can indicate, and I have some precedents to share as well. But also utilizing the glass, utilizing the brick, some of the wood look, and either the same panel or similar panels, but trying to make that all cohesive, as well as the metal panel use. And I'm calling reference to the image above. You can see the red encircled areas to see how we're kind of pulling these pieces, and we'll get more in the elevations. I'm going to share two projects that we have done, ZGF and ZGF with Abbott. The top image is Smoky Point for Tech up near Everett. And then the lower one is the Burian Clinic that we did for Virginia Mason Franciscan Health more recently as well. Both are concrete tilt-up buildings and used them differently, playing with metal panel and glass. The Smoky Point one actually uses wood ipe in this case to kind of put onto the surface. We also can play with the concrete as well as surfacing and getting some recess moments in the structure. The good thing about concrete tilt-up is it's doing the structural work for the most part, as well as determining the envelope. And there's ways that we can do that. And we're working with the team now to kind of find out what does that mean. Is there integral colors? Is it a topical application? Is it using combinations of panels, materials on it? And how do we do so in a cost-effective way that brings the cohesiveness where it needs to be and allows it to be the building to provide the program as it needs to be as also.
So, Craig, just one other thing that the concrete tilt-up allows us to do as well is it is the lateral force-resisting system of the building, which allows us to have a brace-free interior inside the MOB area without having to go to the expense of doing a moment frame. So it's a very economical construction system.
And so this is, elevations are difficult to look at, but from, you know, the way we work in architecture and design helps us kind of look at relationships. And so this is the south elevation. To the left, you can see the ESSB drop off in that elevation. And then I put an image up there just to kind of help tie that relationship together. And then to the right, you can see the loading. You can see the south end of the 1995 building, and then off to the right is parking. And so you can see how we're starting to play with the composition and proportions of the building and the materials. We're also thinking of having a canopy out front. We're determining the size, but to allow that drop-off to have some covered access as folks come in and out of surgery in the clinic so that they can go home and get under cover during the inclement weather. But you know, taking cues from the ESSB for sure.
Good. Of course, in the winter, most of our inclement weather comes from the southeast.
Good to know.
It really sweeps up the bay sometimes and push you off your feet.
Yeah. We will, you do see kind of the upper level there. There's mechanicals. There will be mechanical systems on the roof, similar to the SSB. We're working to kind of mitigate that height and keep it as low as we can. But there'll be some elements up on that structure as well. This is the western view. Now, this is also, this elevation is taken at grade for the new build part, as well as the ESSB, but the real experience is when you're on Sheridan and you're looking at the campus, right? So when you look at the image on the upper left, that's really what you see, unless you lean over the ledge and you look down at the lower level. But you can see how we're, you know, playing off that entry element as well.
That's good. And this won't interfere with the flight path of the helicopters coming in, will it? Because it's too far away, I think.
No. Yeah.
And we're a floor lower.
Yeah.
The rooftop equipment screen is probably about level with the top of the 1995 building, so we should not have any issues.
Great. They had to remove some baffles on the 95 building because a few months after it was constructed, because of the conditions of I guess the arrival of the and takeoff of the helicopters.
Yeah,
they would probably take off towards the southeast, right?
I'm not sure, because of Indian Island, and they're not allowed to fly certain areas. Mike or Aaron Vallette will probably know better than I do, but I know there were some issues there. And then after 9/11, it was their flight path, I think it was changed.
And then we have a couple 3D views to share. These are easier to understand and see. You can see the massing. We try to do these mostly at pedestrian level. We do have some aerials because they're also, they help explain the condition. This would be somewhere near Sheridan and 7th looking at. You can see the parking lot and the ESSB obviously in front of us. You can see the entry point. You can start to see a canopy. couple more views. And granted, this is still schematic design, so we're modeling, but we're building and trying to understand what this is. So there's a lot of artistic interpretation as we're doing this.
I must say, I like the fact that corner 7th and Sheridan corner of the building is matches, or at least is like the one of the ESSB. I think that helps tie it in quite well.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, that's a challenge that we've been having in terms of the ESSB is a 3-story building, and that entry box occurs at the 2nd and 3rd level that you can see in this image here on the left. And, you know, we're a 2-story building trying to, you know, be a more direct sibling of massing and material use. So that's something that we're still and will continue to work on. So this is a view from the ESSB drop-off looking back. Now, just to kind of express where that image, the man in the with the bicycle, that metal clad element behind him is the linear accelerator. Linear accelerator is a serious concrete vault. And so there's no windows, no nothing. And so we're trying to tie it in with the materiality as best we can to the ESSB and hopefully have enough room to kind of do some plantings and whatnot in front of it to soften that. But it is a big thing. So,
well, actually strategically placed behind the column of the ESSB
in the view.
Canopy is there's actually a window that goes into the either the control room or the waiting area for the vault. You can kind of see it right there, that black thing.
Or in the center of this image, you can see a little bit.
Anyway.
So we're trying to put windows where we can for best optimal view. And so the proportions don't always match up to the other existing buildings because of that. So we'll continue to work on window placement. Here's a view from Sheraton. As I mentioned, when you're on Sheraton, you're looking at, this is what most folks driving by Sheraton will see. And then this is from the east parking lot. You can see the 1995 as well as looking back up. And this will be the pathway and the stairs are being developed. Obviously, it's early on, but we'll have safe passage for ADA accessibility to get folks from the parking all the way up, as well as the drop off, as I mentioned. And then there'll be a series of stairs to get folks up. Currently, I know, and I've even parked down here and I walk up and around and you're in the road or you cross across the lawn, but we're going to provide a way up there and it'll be landscaped and whatnot. There are some walls that you're seeing in the loading area, which we're still determining what those walls will be and what elements those are being. All those pieces are still moving. There's some things that we're working around, so the team's working pretty hard on determining what that will be, and we'll share that in future developments. And then
go ahead. Sorry, Craig.
No, Jim, go ahead.
I was just going to say, can we go back to the previous one?
Yeah.
So one of the things that we did try to do on this elevation is kind of capture the rhythm and the proportions of the openings that are in the 1995 building and draw them into the east facade of the new building. We're not quite sure how that's going to resolve at that corner yet, but that's what we're trying to do, is make sure that no matter which side we're looking at this project from, that it hangs together as a campus.
How about a nice mural on that bare wall?
Yeah. Well, we can certainly do that.
Certainly opportunities for art. We welcome that. We've done a lot of that. It's really great way to engage the community and have them participate as well. So, I mean, all that's really wonderful stuff. We're even looking at the elements that are on campus and how to integrate those as well.
Going back to the 95 building, I believe those small windows on the up on the floor there, the second floor in particular, was to emulate a ferry boat. Mm-hmm. That was the thought sense in it. And I think what you've done with this building really ties it in very well. It's a pity that because on that floor in particular, it's the OR, back of the OR, so nobody sees it, or the public don't see it, see the view. But it's really tied in very well, I must say.
Nice work, Craig.
Yeah.
And then we have a couple views here, and I know I'm watching the time too, so I want to make sure we talk about schedule and budget as well. But these are the aerial views I mentioned that just help us understand how the massings are coming together. The roof is fairly complicated in that there's three buildings there that we're going to be tying together. So we're working with our structural engineer pretty closely and Brandon's team on what that's looking like so that we can accommodate that. But a couple just fly around aerials as you spin around. Okay, and then I think that's it for the exterior. So Jim, I'll let you talk about schedule.
May I make one comment here?
Yep.
I am absolutely awed by how you've managed to integrate everything together and come up with such a beautiful design. I can hardly wait.
Oh. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's nice to hear. The team's been working pretty hard and, you know, heads down a lot. So thank you.
Any other comments about materials we presented before we get into the dry part?
No, this is the important part. We're getting into a really important part. No, I think second Jill, absolutely. I mean, it's so well put together with a lot of thought too. So that it's all, if not married, it's engaged together, if you know what I mean. It looks really, I think it should fit in very well. And apart from, you know, getting the logistics of getting produce and whatnot into the cafeteria, and if we have to replace the MRI, I think, it's looking like you're solving things brilliantly.
But we are still working on, you know, on and it's this push me pull you that and so we have the design team that will do anything that we ask them to do. Then we have Brandon, you know, the man with the green eye shade and calculator, and saying, well, that's taking you in the wrong direction, Mike. So it's this balance of making the building look as similar to the ESSB, but in the most cost-effective way, because we don't want to get to a place where, well, we can apply more brick here, which would make the building look more like the ESSB, but in exchange, lose six exam rooms. So we're still tweaking, but I agree with you. I'm really happy with where it's at now, and think it's think that the design team and contractors done a great job meeting us in the middle.
Thanks, Mike. So just a little brief overview of where we are in the schedule. Where that says we are here. So we're about 4 weeks away from the completion of schematic design, which means that at the end of this phase we'll have the plans worked out pretty much the way they're shown now with a little bit more detail. We'll have some elevations. We'll have some interior, more interior development. And there'll be a bit design narrative, which will describe what all the at least the systems are in the building. And in parallel with what we're doing, we're working with the MEP, both the design or the trade partners and the design engineers to work out all the systems that are going within the building. And so there will be, at the end of that, there'll be a package which Abbott can then put together a really good estimate for where we are at the time. After schematic design, then we jump into really the detailed development of all the spaces and all the systems that go into the building. And we're scheduling about 4 months for that. So in the middle of March, we'll have that wrapped up, and that's when we can really get a really good detailed estimate. CDs, which is producing the documents that will go in for permitting and for the contractor to use to build it, will take us another about 4 months. So we're projecting that we're going to start construction probably in August, end of July, beginning of August, and then we're still working out exactly the logistics of how long the construction is going to take, but it will probably take, I can't remember what we had. Josh, do you remember the number? Was it like 80 weeks or something?
It's 16 months.
16 months. So that's just, so I left that, I didn't fix the end of that. That's just the start. That's not the entire part of construction. Any questions about the schedule?
How long do you think demolition will take?
Josh, I'm going to dump that in your lap.
Yeah. We're about a month to 2 months, somewhere in there, depending on the amount of asbestos and ACM hazardous material that needs to be abated.
And that would start?
We're targeting August, September of 2023.
Okay. Thank you.
So about 10 months from now, right?
Okay. And you also showed early on the flow of patients across a blue line, and then north of that, the flow of staff in an orange line. How will the patients flow? That I think it was in a very, very early slide. How will the patients flow? There you go. How are they going to flow when you're doing the demolition derby in the middle of that blue line? Are they then going to be routed up towards through the orange line?
That's a really good question, and we don't have that resolved yet. We're going to be able to maintain the orange connection during construction because we're not going to be doing it well. We're going to have to do a little tweaking in that corridor, but the intent is to maintain that connection throughout construction. But we have not worked out the total logistics package for whether or not we're going to have to construct some kind of temporary connection between the 95 building and the ESSB. And I don't know where that would be at this point. It may be that we're just going to have to use that north corridor for double duty for a while. But we have been thinking about that.
Okay.
So Josh, is Brandon on the call?
But he's got spotty coverage, so I'm gonna put on my green visor and do my best Brandon impression. Do you have that slide with the concept budget?
Yeah.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Josh Sykes, project executive, introduced earlier with Abbott Construction, and Brandon, my estimating pre-construction partner, is probably on a ferry right now with some spotty coverage. So our design build estimate that we've got in front of you is based on the concept that ZGF, the design partner, just presented, including a forecasted guaranteed maximum price, which includes contingencies at just north of $61 million, our construction document completion and design, construction document completion and construction administration for the design portion of that budget estimate is just north of $1 million as well. Adding in the Washington State sales tax at $5.4 million brings us to a total estimated construction cost of $67.7 and some change.
And just to trail that, this is the hard costs of the project. There still are soft costs that bring the project the number north of 75 now. That we are still accounting for and trying to figure out a way to show. I mean, a big chunk has been paid as part of the release of design fees up to this point. Another big chunk is the equipment that we'll have to purchase for the project, and some of that will be tucked into our budget process. But one, I just wanted to let you know that no, the $75 million budget didn't shrink down to 67, but this is just the hard project cost, and there still are soft costs that we probably will have our arms around next month to give you sort of a better view of total project cost estimate.
It seems to me it's a great pity that for a public hospital district that we have to pay sales tax. I realize some of that comes back to the county because it's paid in the county, but it seems a great pity that we can't knock off that $5.5 million somehow or other. Maybe something through the legislature we could advocate for?
Yeah, there's a handful of public hospital district projects going on right now, including at Moses Lake and Quincy, and we had a similar discussion with Matt from AWA PhD, and it's possible that there might be a discussion about not elimination of sales tax, but some sort of rebate provision, because everybody agrees that that's a sensible thing to eliminate, municipal tax on a municipal corporation, but on the other hand, pretty hard to make go away. but we're asking questions, Mari.
Yeah. Maybe we should offer the assessor's office free health care.
Sure. But if that doesn't do it, free meals, right, Case? That'll seal the deal.
Well, that concludes our presentation. Are there any other questions that we can answer?
No, I think it's brilliant. What you've been doing is brilliant. Thank you so much.
One quick question in terms of hard costs. The linear accelerator and the space for that, how much of the space for that is included in this versus the machine itself?
The cost of the construction of the vault in the suite is in this number. The linear accelerator itself and the associated equipment that goes with that is not the medical equipment piece.
Okay.
Would that be included in the soft costs, Mike?
Yeah. Or? Yep. Exactly. Yeah, you're going to see like a $9-11 million soft cost number of equipment and furnishings and the like that we are still trying to get our arms around. So we still have some work to do on all facets of this, but it's heading in the right direction, and we're happy with where it's going.
So I can see why. It's an amazing project and very thoughtfully designed. It just seems like you've taken every consideration into it. Thank you. Any other questions?
Can I backtrack on Case's question about the cost of the vault? Or is that just all, the actual vault?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have a cost just for that?
Oh, I don't know, Josh. Do we have a number that's directly associated with that?
I don't think we have a direct number, but I could ballpark it in the $3 to $5 million range.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you.
And is that mostly concrete, or are there other things to shield?
It's probably 40% concrete, and then the rest finishes, interior, studs, flooring. There's a significant portion of lighting that goes into those things.
But it doesn't need lead or other things in the vault.
It may have some steel shielding, depending on the thickness. We're still at the SD right. level where we haven't gotten to the physicist aspect where.
Yep.
They tell us if there's 3 inches of steel sheeting necessary because of adjacencies.
So our assumption at this point is that we're going to use a high density concrete and steel plate in order to reduce the actual thickness of the concrete where we can, simply because it's a lot of concrete if we don't do that. And it's in a very prominent location next to the entry, and we don't really want to have this big pillbox there any bigger than it needs to be. So we're trying to balance the cost versus the amount of space it takes up and what it looks like.
Thank you.
Don't forget murals.
I'm interested to see how those tilt up concrete panels work. My gosh, it must be a huge project in itself.
Could I also ask about the roof materials? What's the I'm familiar with roofs here where I live at the Eco Village, using structurally insulated panels, where you just get these panels pre-made. They've got sandwiched insulation, and a roof goes on a 3,000 square foot building in a day with insulation and everything. What kind of materials are you using for that?
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think we've determined it yet. I think we're looking at different roofing systems, and we'll work with the building systems facilities on, you know, maintenance and those needs, so that we're aligning with them on that. So it's I think being proposed is like a membrane type roof, which is, I think, is what's similar to the ESSB.
Yeah, but I'm wondering about the structural and insulation part, and I hope you're considering something like structurally insulated panels.
We could certainly look at that. I mean, right now, budgetary wise, in terms of we're looking at what's a fairly standard construction technique, which is we have steel frame that's supporting the roof, and we have a metal deck, and where we need to have some additional vibration isolation and structural integrity, we've got some concrete, which is where the mechanical systems are sitting on top of. And then we have rigid insulation, which is built up on top of the deck. And then the membrane deck, the membrane roofing on top of that.
Got it.
So it's a pretty standard construction technique right now, pretty typical at this point.
Any other questions or comments? Well, Jim, Craig, Joshua, thank you so much. It's been an excellent presentation, even though it sounds like it was done under fire. You did an awesome job pulling that out of the hat. It's great.
I knew they would. They were stressed out. I said, you guys always knock it out of the park. But I probably don't appreciate the working straight through 2.5 days to get the work done. But it's been really fun and productive working with the entire team, both Abbott and ZGF.
That's
not something you often hear when it comes to construction projects either. well done.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We really appreciate the chance to present where we're at with you all. And I'm sure we'll be talking with you again. And we only had a few hiccups in this one, so we'll try and iron those out as we go forward.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Craig. Jim, much
appreciate
it. Thank you.
So we will recess now for 15 minutes and be back at 3:30. So, see you then. Okay. Good afternoon. Welcome back to our October 25th, 2022 Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Commission meeting. So we begin with a patient story from our Chief Nursing Officer, Tina Toner. Tina, all yours. Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I have some wonderful recognition to share with you today, and it is recognition of our medical staff. And as you know, I think there's, you know, many of our patient stories begin with one of the members of our great medical staff team. And so I wanted to just showcase some awards that were given out in recognition. A couple of weeks ago at our medical staff symposium. These awards were given by the medical staff. So they were nominated by their peers. And I just wanted to spotlight some of this work. So the first award went to Dr. Matt Crowell, and it was the Dr. Osler Award, which is for being a go-to for help with complex patient care concerns. Our second award was the Mentorship Award, and that was given to Dr. Ivan Mendez and for offering support and guidance to his colleagues. The next award was Grace Under Fire, and this award was given to both Dr. Molly Hong and Dr. Steve Erickson, and they were recognized for keeping it together when things get hairy. The fourth award, our Changemaker Award, was given to Dr. Molly Parker. This recognized someone with thoughtful, creative solutions to the never-ending dilemmas in healthcare. Our Legend Award was given to Dr. Jay Lawrence, someone with a legacy of service to the medical community. And then lastly, our Unicorn Award, Dr. Christine Skorberg, recognized for pulling a rabbit out of the hat and saving the day. We had a wonderful story to share that caused her to be nominated for that award. So just a big thank you to this well-deserving group of physicians, well-deserved recognition, and a big thank you to all of our medical staff for all they do every day.
That is certainly echoed by us. That's wonderful. Thank you. Congratulations to everyone. Well deserved.
Jill?
Yes.
May I add a 1 minute patient story that I'd like to share?
All right. Thank you, Tina.
I had pain in my left shoulder for a couple of months. I was able to very expeditiously get an MRI at Jefferson Healthcare. Extremely professional staff. It was just amazing, the service and the care that they gave me during the MRI. And within 2 hours, I had the results read by the radiologist. And even though the results were not good news, I won't blame the staff for that. And I just want to call out that our imaging staff are just amazing people.
Great. Well, thank you, Case. You're not prejudiced, are you?
I'm not what?
Prejudiced, are you, towards it?
Oh, no, not at all.
That's a joke. All right. Thank you. Anybody else have any comments about patient story or the awards that the medical staff received? Okay, then we will move on to the minutes from September 28th, regular meeting. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I went right over public comment, which is next. So we now invite public comment from our audience. If you would rather write your comments rather than engage in public comment here, you can direct your emails to commissioners@jeffersonhealthcare.org or address mail to commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, 98368. Brittany, have we received any comments from the public that you're aware of?
I have not seen any mail come through recently. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Brittany. Then in-person speakers, there is a 3-minute limit, and Brittany will give you a 1-minute warning before your time's up. It's the board's policy to listen to your comments without responding, and if you have a question, please submit it in writing so we can give it our full attention and reply accordingly. Thank you. So anyone who wishes to speak, please use that raised hand icon down on your screen there. And we would love to hear from you. So giving you the opportunity now to do that. Brittany, do you see any raised hands that we might not see?
Scrolling through the list of attendees, I do not see anyone currently raising their hand.
Okay. All right. Then we will go on then, and there will be another opportunity at the budget hearing for the public to comment on the budget, and that's coming up real quick here. So next on the agenda are minutes from September 28th regular and October 19th special. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
I'll second.
Okay. Second. All right, Mari moved and Kay seconded. Is there discussion? All right, everyone in favor, raise your hand, please. Okay, thank you, unanimous. Required approvals, anything a commissioner would like to discuss separately? If not, then may I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
So moved.
Okay, moved and seconded. Is there discussion? All in favor, raise your hand, please. It's unanimous. Okay, thank you. So now we will move in.
Did we approve both of the last minutes, or did I miss something?
We approved both. I read them as September 28th regular meeting and October 19th.
I missed that. Thanks.
Would you prefer to?
No, not at all. I just missed that when you said that.
Okay, not right. Thank you. Okay, then we will go on to the budget hearing. I now open the public hearing for Jefferson County Public Hospital District's budget for fiscal year 2023. The budget hearing presentation can be located on our website at www.jeffersonhealthcare.org. Choose About Us, then Hospital Commissioners, and it will be under Meeting Agendas and Minutes, 2022 meetings, October 26th, and budget presentation. Our Chief Financial Officer, Tyler Freeman, will present both the operations and capital budgets. Following his presentation, we will take public comment regarding the budget, and when all members of the public who wish to speak have been heard, commissioners will enter discussion on the budget and the attendant property tax levy resolution. Action will be taken on Resolution 2022-09, which is a property tax levy, either with or without tax increase, depending on what the board decides, and on Resolution 2022-10 to adopt the fiscal year budget, 2023 annual budget. So, Mr. Freeman, would you like to begin, please?
Right. So these slides are going to look very familiar to everyone because they are the same exact ones with the same great stock photos that we had last week. So I think we only have 20 minutes instead of the hour. So I'll do a little bit faster of a flyover, and we've already done the deep dive into a lot of the questions. So this should be relatively painless. But if you want to go on to the next slide. So first off, we'll same agenda as last time. I think I only added one slide after our discussion, but we'll talk about our process, philosophy, dive into the operating budget, then capital, and then any questions. But you can always stop me if you have a question throughout the presentation as well too. And I have my Teams chat going on, so I see things flying through. I did get a question already on why the fireplace background. That was my we're going to start fireside finance. It's going to be a regular thing, so get excited to the team member who just asked me that question. Next slide. So again, setting the landscape, vocab reference coming up next. I want to go ahead to that one. So gross revenue, these are the charges that we have. When we do our budgets, we increase these for two different reasons. One is just going to be volume based. So we may make some changes if we expect volumes to change. There's also price increases or price changes that can impact the gross revenue as well. And then the net revenue is what we actually expect to collect from that. So that's usually about 45 cents on the dollar is our typical collection rate. Everything that we write off is going to go to one of our contractual adjustment accounts, bad debt or charity. When we talk about FTEs, even though we do have some folks that are not 2080 hours for being an FTE, that's what we calculate everything in the budget as. So everything is based on a 1.0 would equal 2080 hours. We do have folks that are classified as full-time that are less than 2080 hours. And then one of the big metrics we look at the end, operating total margin. You can see the definition right there. And just a reminder, for healthcare, traditionally a 2 to 6% margin is considered healthy. Next slide. Budget process, don't have to go over it all. A lot of work went into it, a lot of work from the department leaders, a lot of work from the finance folks, a lot of work by the SLGs to work with their department leaders and go through it. Really appreciate everyone's assistance as we go through this process and make sure that we get it as clean as we possibly can. There's a lot that goes into this, as you can see by just how long it takes. We kicked this off in July. We're just wrapping it up right now, and we needed every minute to get through it to make sure that we were had our strategies down and had all the numbers in it, everyone's budget correctly. Next slide. A few just kind of high level things about our philosophy and what we tried to do. So for each department, we were really shooting for margin improvement. It's something that we're always shooting for, but you know, there's reports on the daily on financials, the financials of a lot of health systems that are not doing well, in our state, not doing well nationally. We definitely need to focus on our margins, because most of our funding, as you'll see, is from our operations. And so we need to be self-sufficient. We need to make it from our departments. And so we have to have them be focused on that margin improvement year over year. And then another theme as we've been running through our 2022 finances, and as you're looking around the landscape, is there's been a ton of contract labor expenses. We did not budget for contract labor. So we instead decided, we made the choice that instead of trying to split hairs and decide how many folks are we going to hire versus how much are we going to contract out, we went with the assumption that if there's a need for it, if we need a body, we're going to hire that person. So let's budget for the FTE. So we're shooting for hiring folks, which will mean that our FTE number is going to be on the little bit of the high side. And if we're not able to fill those positions, we're going to have overages in contract labor throughout the year of 2023. But it'll be something that at least we know what we did. We can expect it. We should see that shift as we kind of have this year from salaries and wage expense to contract labor expense, if that's what continues to persist in 2023. And then we do have a 4.5% price increase. We had a third party that reviewed our prices. According to their analysis, we could have even increased that higher. They looked at our local market, which included some of the critical access hospitals and one PPS hospital nearby. They also pulled in the Washington critical access hospital average, and we were below market in a lot of areas. And so the suggestion was a 4.5% price increase. So knowing how much our expenses have increased year over year, a 4.5% won't even quite get us there. But it was something that we felt comfortable with after reviewing all of the data with the third party. And then the next slide, I believe, if you want to move ahead, actually shows our pricing history. So this is new from last time. We didn't talk about this, or we did talk about, but I didn't have a slide for it. So this is going into since 2008, what have we done with our prices? And so you can see most facilities are going to increase 3 to 5% annually. That's because there's going to be inflation on your expenses. Most payer contracts allow for 3 to 5%, some even more annually. And so a lot of places try and take advantage of that by just saying, we're just going to across the board, you know, raise our rates. We had some pretty steep increases in the past. You can see around 2008, 2009, 2010, we had some significant increases to our charges. And since around the 2012, that dropped down to 5%, 2013, 2.9. We've been around that 1.253 range for quite a while now. In 2018, I actually didn't even, a decrease was noted in the slides for the budget presentation, but I don't have an overall number for that. So we can just assume that that was zero. And 2019 was pretty similar. It looked like, you know, there's some departments that had 10% cuts in their prices. There was other departments that had 5-7% increases. It was just a little bit all over the board. And I see Mike's on. He may have some more color commentary to the history too, because I obviously have only been around for the 2022 3% increase that we had, and then this 2023 4.5% overall.
Well, I think in the early 2010s, we had two competing goals. One, we had to increase cash because of our cash position, and two, we had to decrease charges because our charges, the rest of the market had sort of gotten to a lower overall place with our charges. And it's hard to do both of those things at the same time. So our approach was just instead of a couple of big whacks on our charges, we implemented below market, below inflation rate increases every year. And helped out our cash position by just growing volumes. So it was kind of this slow and painful slog of writing, and then I think that we've gotten to this point where we are at a market or a below market price point, which is a great place to be. And I think this slide just shows you you've heard that axiom, get rich slowly. This is sort of fix our pricing position slowly, but we're in a good place now. And I think the reason we wanted to show you this is because the rate increase that we are recommending this year is probably the highest since 2012. But I think it's appropriate given our overall rate, our position in the market right now, and two, our rate increase is about half of what you're seeing in many inflationary numbers across the economy. So we just wanted to point that out. And I think it was Case who asked to see this, if I recall.
Yes, thank you very much, Mike. That's an extremely helpful slide. Or Tyler, whoever prepared it.
and I think, with some of that correction of the price increase with that, really low increases or decreases in certain years, we can definitely see that we are even the low cost leader in a decent chunk of charges. I mean, looking at a charge master is enough to, It's too much data for me to even take in, because there's 3,000 or so items on that. So it's pretty hard to do this analysis, and that's why we have a third party kind of review it. But there are some areas where it was very apparent we're significantly below market and the low cost leader now because of the low increases we've had year over year, where other facilities are probably increasing quite a bit. And then on the next slide too, we have our property tax assessment. And one of the ways that you can have have really low prices and be the low cost leader is if you're getting it through your tax assessment. Tax assessment, is almost like having a starting built-in margin from the beginning of the year. Well, our built-in margin is $516,000 or $521,000 if we do the 1% increase. We have a really low levy rate, second lowest in the state for public hospital districts. And the other thing to note is the significant increase in the property tax assessments from 2022 to 2023. don't impact how much we receive in tax revenue. We only are able to take, without a levy lift, you can only do the 1% over your prior year tax assessment. So we will only be able to increase it that $5,022 if we choose to do the resolution that includes the 1% increase. The other points we had on this last time that we talked about were budgeted average daily expenditures are about $430,000. So by about lunch on January 2nd, we have used up all of our tax assessment. And so we are definitely running off of our own operations as it comes to being able to pay for all of the staff, facilities, everything else that we need. And then our tax rate too, if you were to put this down to an individual level and say, what would a home appraised at $400,000 pay? I was surprised to see that on the assessor's office, the median home in Port Townsend was $380,000, which was pretty close to what it was for the county as well. But a $400,000 appraisal would pay $24 a year with our estimated levy rate of 0.05995. Next slide. And then looking at how that compares to other hospital districts in our region, there's a few of these, like Whidbey up at the top. I pulled these from the Department of Health website. Some of this data is a little bit outdated if they haven't received the financials yet. So Whidbey's is from 2019, and Island is from 2020. But you can see the 2021 operating expenses for all the other facilities and their total tax revenues. I think one of the more striking things is Forks, that is significantly smaller than us in terms of total operating expense budget, but still with a higher amount of tax revenue, and definitely with a lower tax base underneath their district as well. And then next slide. I didn't add anything to this, although I do have some of the numbers. We can talk about this as well. So we talked through the other pieces that the hospital needs to support that that we're not getting any additional revenue for. And some of that's our community benefits. So free and discounted care, charity care for those that are under 400% of the federal poverty line. In 2021, this amounted to $3.9 million. We also had $5.5 million of uncompensated care bad debt in 2021. That was higher than normal because of COVID, but still we usually range around $3 to $4 million in bad debt in a given year. And then we do offer a benefit that I've never seen before, even when I audited public hospital districts and other healthcare systems, which is 100% of the employees that receive their care at Jefferson do not have to pay their portion of patient responsibility. And in 2021, we wrote off $685,000 worth of employee patient responsibility. That usually is around $600,000 to $1 million. And then some of the other community benefits that that we talked about, but I didn't add here, was just, we do have, as you'll see, I think we are budgeting for just under 700 total FTEs. There's over 800 folks that work at Jefferson now, and our budgeted salary expense would be about $222,000 per day pumped into the local economy. Next slide. All right, on to the operating budget. Go ahead. So this is substantially the same as what you saw last time. The only difference is, if you recall, we talked about that 4.5% price increase was being applied in an overall level, and the third party that worked on that for us was getting that back to us at a department level. That did make some shifts in the revenue adjustment section, but the overall number stayed the same at 54.37% being written off. The total patient revenues up at the top, $347 million, that is about a 2% volume increase, and the rest of that is due to increases in the charge master, the 4.5%. And then we did book $285,000 in the grants budget. We will hopefully be getting significantly more than 285, but we don't have anything kind of locked down. So we wanted to get a number in there, but we are hopeful that that will be higher than what we have. And so total operating revenue sitting in almost $164 million. And the other thing, I'll point this out, it is a little confusing, is the revenues, credit balance, they look like they're a negative. Expenses, debit balance, they're the positive. So as you look at this, it can be a little confusing, especially if you look at the change. If you're not used to looking at it in the typical debit credit form to see, is this good or is this bad? You know, change from up at the top of total patient revenues being in the negative, that's good. If you were to see the expenses in the negative, that would also be good. So it's a little tricky. You got to keep your eye on the sign if you want to really read through this. You want to go ahead to the next one. We've got the expense budget. So again, this didn't change from last time. $81 million in salaries for those almost 700 FTEs that we're hoping to have. About the same benefits rate. One thing that we talked about a little bit last time, but I wanted to add to, is the purchase services amount. So purchase services is higher for a couple reasons. Those are not the travelers. Those aren't the contract labor. What that includes is third parties that we hire to do certain other work for us, or assist with, it can be like an IT project where it's implementations, where if we get a new software service, something like that, those are the purchase services. We do have about $2 million of additional purchase service that is being booked, and it's being booked as an estimate for Skagit Radiology. And so that contract, it works different than our previous Radia agreement with Radia. They were the ones that were billing the patient. They were the ones that were collecting on the professional fees. With Skagit, we will be billing patients. So they will no longer be getting, you know, a bill from Jefferson and then a bill from Radia. They will only be getting bills from Jefferson. And we had to, since we've never done that billing before, we had to estimate, well, how much do we think we're going to have? What's the volume going to look like? What are the RVUs? We pay Skagit based on a per RVU basis. And our kind of conservative estimate was this is going to be about $2 million. And we spread that out between the different radiology departments. And then we booked corresponding revenue associated with that as well, about almost $4 or $5 million of professional fees, and we calculated that number to basically wipe out our extra expense. So we booked it as if it was going to be a net neutral. You know, it's going to increase expenses, it's going to increase revenue, but it's not going to impact bottom line at all. It would be a net zero for the two. So hopefully that made sense. But let me know if I can clarify any further. And other than that, I mean, the remaining expense items, the only other big difference is leases, rentals looks pretty low. It looks low because a decent amount of those are now going to become capital leases, will not be operating leases anymore. And so those will move up onto the balance sheet and then have interest expense and depreciation associated with them instead of lease expense. And that's just something that was a change in accounting standard. Total operating income, $4.7 million. And on the next slide, we have some of the non-operating, which we have, you know, as I said, pretty much everything we do is operations-based. We don't have a lot of non-operating, not a ton of taxes, not a ton of investment income since we invest in the LGIP. And the biggest bucket is our interest expense. But our total margin is sitting at almost 2.9, same as operating. Salaries and benefits as a percent of net patient service revenue, just under 63. And supplies expense as a percent of net patient service revenue, just under 20. So both of those are where we want them to be in terms of total numbers.
Hey, Tyler, I'll just comment on the switch to Skagit Radiology from Radia and the impact that it's having on the operating budget. I think it's a good thing because Radia was a good group, but they, you know, they would send out the bill and it was a different bill than Jefferson Healthcare, and that was confusing to some of our patients. And secondly, although they worked with us real well, sometimes their charity care policies lagged behind ours. So it was just another player out there to have to try to manage. So I think when this gets up and running and we get real comfortable with billing for diagnostic imaging professional services, this will be a good thing for our community. I will say there's a little bit of trepidation just because it's a new skill set we're going to have to adopt. But I mean, we've done that. You know, we did that in anesthesiology. We did that in emergency room. It's something that we've managed to pick up quickly. And I think overall it'll be a good thing for our community. Just more of a centralized Jefferson Healthcare bill that's sent out to our patients.
Thanks, Mike. Then if there are no other questions on the operating budget, we can move ahead to the next slide, which starts going into all of the stats that would have driven these budgets. And so the budget that we were just going over was created by department leaders based on June data annualized. The stats numbers that I have here, just to give you the most recent when we created it, was through August. We've just finished September now, but through August annualized. So some of the variances that you see are just the difference between the June annualized and the August annualized numbers. You know, when you look at ICU patient days, it's I would gather that when that department was budgeted for, they just assumed 2022 year-to-date annualized is going to be my 2023 budget. I don't think it's going to go up. I don't think it's going to go down. I think it's going to be about the same. And what happened was, while that number was annualized at 1,270 in June, it's annualized at 1,289 in August. And so there's a slight decrease. So you may see stuff like that as you go through. It's not significant in the overall, and these budgets are like all budgets are just more direction setting and guesstimates, and no one will guess their statistic exactly right for the entire year. And as we go through this first page, you know, some of the big ones that we talked about last time, you know, almost 700 FTEs. This is a big increase from 2022, as we still have you know, some staff that we are working to hire, but it's really not that big of a change from 2022's budget. So 2022 budget, we're at 674. So we're just looking at about 25 more folks than last year's budget. And then one of the other bigger pieces, mammographies, that's obviously having the change from Radia to Skagit and not being able to do those for a period of time. There's going to be a big increase, and we expect that service line to get back on track in 2023. Next slide.
Can I just ask you why, if you go back, Tyler, the swing beds, you're anticipating less swing bed activity?
So swing beds was one of those that it was very infrequently used at the very beginning of this year. And through June, the annualized number was 20. That has started to pick back up slightly. And so now the year-to-date actual is at 95. Swing bed is something that we probably have some opportunity in utilizing more so than we do right now. Those are set up for critical access hospitals to be able to utilize as basically a skilled nursing day. A lot of critical access hospitals are located in areas where they don't have access to any skilled nursing. And while we do have access, we aren't flush with access. So it's probably one that, we could have bumped up that number, and we may even want to before we send the final in, because it should be higher than 20, and we should be utilizing it a lot more than probably even 95 or even 190. A lot of webinars that I've been on actually suggest shooting for an average daily census of around 4 swing patients.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if it was because of the, I believe, the move to do outpatient or home the same day total joints, whether that's decreased it, but I understand your rationale. So great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Could I ask, is the payment different on those beds? How does that technically work?
It's a most of those are they're going to be Medicare patients that qualify for swing status. And so those are paid a per diem rate, and it's calculated similar to our inpatient days, where they are taking our cost and determining how much we should be receiving on a daily basis. Since we utilize them so infrequently, our rate is actually pretty high, because they're saying you have a lot of cost and not a lot of volume. And so as what happens if you start to get a swing bed program up and running and having a lot more utilization, is you'll actually see that cost drop pretty significantly, because you'll start to have volume in it again.
Got it.
So probably the revenue won't change an awful lot then.
At first it would, and then it'll cover more of the cost of some of those folks in those areas, is what will happen.
Okay, thanks.
Right, and then again, some of these departments that you see big increases on are either shut down for a bit because of COVID or staffing or other issues, like pulmonary rehab, speech therapy. Both of those had COVID related impacts and staffing related impacts. The rest of them are pretty normal increases when you look at it. A lot are just looking to get back on track. We didn't quite hit some of our budget expectations and so far in 2022. And so for some, you'll see that we flexed a little bit lower than our 2022 budget. Maybe we're thinking we overshot the mark a little bit, and we need to actually throttle that down. And some we've got a pretty sizable increase, hoping to get the service back on track altogether. The next slide. Yep, and same thing here. Nothing too exciting to note. When it comes down to some services like home health and hospice have pretty sizable increases in their budget. And they also, those are our staffing related increases. So when we look at their expenses, you see that, you know, they're trying to get the FTEs that are needed to meet the demand. The demand is there, it's just that the bodies aren't. And so if we're not able to get the staff, some of those departments aren't going to be able to hit their volume budgets in 2023. But again, if we're budgeting for staff, let's budget for the volume. So the hope is that we'll be able to realize both within next year, because there's definitely a community need for those services.
So do you think, or Lisa's, what thoughts are there to opening the cafeteria up to the general public again? I see we've dietary meals is actually anticipated to be less than we've served this year. So where are we with that?
And I think the dietary meals is projected to be less because of the transition that would happen, and they would need to, they're not going to have their full kitchen available all of 2023 if the construction goes as expected. And yeah. So there will be some impact to them. They'll probably have to have a little bit of a different model in 2023 towards the tail end of it. And I don't have an update for when it will be open to the public again.
Thanks.
I don't know if anyone else that's on the line does, but I do not.
Nope.
All right. And then talking about service disruption, that's a good time to go into capital and projects budget. So move ahead to the next slide. The big one is hospital replacement project. And, you know, similar to everything that we've talked about, these are our best guess, right? And these are driving these are going through what our strategies are, what we're hoping to do, what we're hoping to accomplish, and how much we're hoping to spend on it. But nothing is set in stone. And so, you know, that's definitely apparent with the hospital replacement project. We have some expenses that we've put in for 2023, 24, and 25. But those will not be the amounts that we spend in any of those years. But we do know that it's going to cost us about that amount. And so we wanted to get something on paper for it as a placeholder. So we do have some other big construction type projects with an air handler unit. Those are always pretty expensive. You look at the new equipment bucket, we don't have a lot in 2023 that's high dollars, pretty low amounts in the 2023, and we do have the Philips CT in 2024 that is on the more expensive side. And then on the next slide, we have our routine replacement equipment, and outside of the building, that's actually our biggest bucket, is we just have a lot of equipment that needs replacing. Chemistry analyzers need replacing. We talked a lot about that last time. We've got some MRI expense out in the future that we're budgeting for, some other radiology equipment that needs replaced in 2023. And then not a ton in the software and tech side, though we do have a few pieces that, again, just need upgraded in 2023. Some of these, you know, I've been probably held off a little bit or you know, maybe put on the back burner through COVID, and we've got to, you know, make sure that we keep up on our capital purchases so that we don't run into any issues where we've got downtime because we have outdated old equipment that's not functioning properly.
And I mentioned during the construction presentation that we were working on kind of reconciling a couple of different budgets that accounts for all of the costs associated with the project, even though some are tucked into different budgets. And I think a great example is, you know, we saw $67 million of construction project related cost in the budget document or the cost summary document presented today. In the capital budget, you'll see in 2025, the MRI we have targeted in this budget. So we are doing the work so we can present it sort of in an apples to apples way and maintain the integrity of the different budgets and where we will be sticking them, but also allow you to sort of get a feel for what the total cost of the project is going to be, and more and of equal importance, the funding sources for it.
And now is a good time to go to the next slide, which is, are there any questions besides all of those that we kind of posed throughout? I was hoping to get through a little faster, but it's just a lot of information to get through. So hopefully everyone had their questions answered.
You did a great job, Tyler. Thank you. Any questions from the board? All right, then we now encourage public comment on the budget. Anyone, please limit your comments to 3 minutes, and we will track the time and notify you when 30 seconds is left to wrap up. If you're comfortable providing your name and place of residence, please do so at the beginning of your comments. Thank you. So anyone who wishes to speak on this budget, please use the raise hand icon on your screen at this time. I'm not seeing any. Brandy, are you seeing any that I might be overlooking?
Not seeing any as I scroll through the list of attendees.
All right, thank you. We'll give you another couple of seconds here just in case. Still nothing. Okay. Then I now close public comment and the board will begin deliberations. Mike, can you give us your recommendation and information that you'd like to share with us on this?
Well, with respect to the motion?
We don't have a motion yet. To the levy, we will first consider the tax levy, so that, you know, that you can, if you have a recommendation on whether or not we should take the resolution with or without the tax is.
I recommend that we take it with the tax increase of 1%.
Okay. All right. Commissioners, comments?
So my question is, so taking the 1%, that means we would increase the amount that we receive from the tax levy would be how much extra, Tyler?
About $5,022 and some cents on that.
Would it help? That $5,000 over, that's over all the property tax payers in the county, right?
Yeah, so with the property tax increase that I showed on that slide, with the assessed rates going up so significantly, even with the 1% increase, everyone's levy rate would go down from last year.
Amazing. Thank you.
Would it? Let me read the resolution for the property tax increase and that is resolution 2022-09. Whereas the Board of Commissioners has properly given notice of the public hearing held October 26, 2022 to consider the hospital district's current expense budget for the 2023 calendar year pursuant to RCW 84.55.120, and Whereas the Board of Commissioners, after hearing and after duly considering all relevant evidence and testimony presented, has determined that Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 requires increase in property tax revenue from the previous year, in addition to the increase resulting from the addition of new construction and improvements to property and any increase in the value of state assessed property, in order to discharge the expected expenses and obligations of Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 and in its best interest. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Board of Commissioners that an increase in the regular property tax levy, in addition to any amount resulting from the addition of new construction and improvements to property, refunds from the previous year, and any increase in the value of state assessed property, is hereby authorized for the 2023 levy of $496,034.58, which is a percentage increase of 1% from the previous year, adopted and approved by the Board of Commissioners. So we're looking at a 1% increase of $4,911.23. That's the increase. So is there a motion? Does anyone want to make a motion to adopt the budget levy?
I'll make a motion that we adopt resolution 2022-09.
Second. With the property tax.
With the increase.
With the increase, correct.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. Is there further discussion? Hearing none. Pardon me?
Yeah.
I have my hand up.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't see it. Okay, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to point out that Tyler talked about for a $400,000 house that the total amount they pay is about $24 a year. The 1% increase means they would pay an additional 24 cents in a year.
Thank you.
Well noted. All right. Then any other discussion? All right, all commissioners vote in favor of it. Raise your hand, please. Matt, I don't see you on the screen.
I vote yes. Matt,
are you all right? That's a yes. Then that is unanimous. Then we have adopted and approved resolution 2022-09 with the levy increase. And now we will go to resolution,
where is
it? 2022-10? Yes, for adoption of the 2023 annual budget. There it is. Would anybody like me to read this, or are you okay with it? It's public records, so anybody can read it whenever they want. But
I would like to move that we approve resolution 2022-10 adopting the fiscal year 2021 budget. No, that's not.
No, 23
budget. It says 21 budget in the copy that I have.
That was a typo on my part, Case. I didn't catch that the previous dates was still there. It is the 2023 budget.
Okay, then I will move that we adopt resolution 2022-10, adopting the fiscal year corrected 2023 budget as written.
Very good. All right, it's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? All right, everyone, please raise their hand if they're in favor. Matt, are you in favor?
Yep.
Okay. That's unanimous. Thank you, everyone. We have adopted the 2023 budget and the levy increase.
I don't think this will impact any of the approvals, motions, or anything, but I did just get a text that we should change swing bed to 200 days. So in one, it was 195, I believe, in 2021 or 2022 budget. So this would be about 10 more days above the 2022 budget. So not significant, but wanted to point it out that we would make that change if you were amenable to it and send that in with our final budget numbers.
Thank you. I think that's perfectly fine since it's a budget.
So can I go in and increase some other of Tina's budgets?
No.
All right. No. Oh, okay.
Clip well, all your head.
All right. Fair enough.
Good try.
Right. Nice try. Okay, thank you, Tyler. Thank you, Mike. Well done. I know that's a Herculean job to get that budget out. So you did great. Thank you. So we next, continuing with our regular meeting, Brandy Manuel, our Chief Patient and Safety Officer, is going to present the Patient Safety and Quality Report. Brandy?
Thank you. Next slide, Brittany. It's always fun to follow the budget presentation. And when he starts it with fireside finance, I get a little nervous about how to find something that rhymes with quality. So I didn't even try. But here is just a reminder, our goal on our strategic plan is to deliver the highest quality care to our community. And we aim to do that in four different ways: by delivering care guided by the best evidence, designing the most effective performance improvement system, continuing the transition to value-based care, and enhancing systematic approach to avoiding medical errors. Next slide. So today we're going to talk a little bit about delivering care guided by the best evidence. And I wanted to share a little bit about a project that I don't talk much about here, but that we're actively engaged in along with several other states' critical access hospitals. So the Medicare Beneficiary Quality Improvement Program, or MBQIP as we call it, focuses on quality improvement efforts across 45 states focused on rural communities and specifically critical access hospitals. And the goal is really by working together and recognizing that critical access hospitals have just a different makeup and different opportunities for improvement than some of our urban counterparts. And by working together, we hope to raise quality across the country in rural areas. So this is a program that we are involved in. We report every month our quality data. Some of it is pulled from our publicly reported data, and some of it is just reported to the state of Washington, who manages the funds for Washington State for this program. And in 2021, they did a critical access hospital needs assessment, and I just thought it was worth pointing out here. We talk about advocacy and we talk about the work that Dunia and Mike and our board does when they go to Washington, D.C., but we don't always get to see what advocacy means. And across the country and across Washington State last year, the needs that rose to the surface are things that we are already working on. And so I just thought it was really worth pointing out. Affordable housing made the list for the workforce. Looking at services for homeless populations, looking at options for long-term care, so post-acute care needs in rural communities, including adult family homes, home health, and then specialty services, including specifically oncology, dental, and labor and delivery. So looking at those, it's just nice to see that, as usual, our leadership team is out in front of those things and advocating for them for our community, as well as other rural communities across the state. So also in 2021, worth pointing out that all of the critical access hospitals reported they were seeing sicker patients. So it's not just a figment of our imagination. We really are seeing sicker patients come. Wait times are longer, and you'll see we're going to take a look at our throughput times again today. But across the state, you'll see that wait times are a little bit higher than they are elsewhere in the country. And that has to do with the demand on our healthcare systems and ability to transfer patients in and out out of tertiary care centers. And then just noting the difficulty to discharge patients following admissions. And we've talked a lot about that here. And our team, I know, is working on that from an advocacy perspective. But it resonated with the rest of the critical access hospitals across the state as well. So just kind of a picture of kind of how things are going across the state. And I think it's important to take that into context as we also look at our performance in delivering evidence-based care. Next slide. So starting, this is our most recent MBQIP report. And so you keep in mind that these are a little bit old. So I've got updated data in front of me for some of these. But you can see for our cardiac core measures, we did not have any patients that met the inclusion for this criteria. Many of these patients end up being identified in the field and being transferred before they come to Jefferson Healthcare. So we didn't have any patients to look at for this particular measure. Then looking at our throughput times, as we often do, this is for emergency department arrival to departure for patients who are being discharged home. So not those that are being transferred and not those that are being admitted, but those who are being discharged home. You can see we're at about 149 minutes. That's a little bit higher than across the state, but it is a little bit lower than where we have been in the last several months. So down just a little bit for us. Fairly consistent with what we're seeing in the state, and then higher, as I mentioned earlier, than the overall scores across the country. Patients that leave the ED without being seen, we are at 1%. A couple of years ago, we were kind of sitting at 2% pretty consistently, so the emergency department's done a great job in bringing this number down. This is a really important one from a safety perspective. We don't want people leaving before they have the opportunity to be seen by a physician and get their medical screening exam. So I'm really glad to see this one come down. The ER has done a great job there. You can see that compares to 2% in Washington and 1% across the country. Healthcare provider influenza vaccinations, we saw a decrease last year. So we, the last couple years prior, had been at 95% and 91% respectively. Last year, we were at 83%. But that is pretty, again, consistent with what we're seeing across the country. It was a low year for influenza, probably partly in due in part to lots of masking, hand hygiene, still social distancing last year. So with that, we saw fewer influenza vaccines. You can see down in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a graph that kind of shows how we've done the last couple of years. And we're the blue line that sits on top. You can see it across the state and across the country, they saw kind of the same trend. So very much in line with where others are at. But we are aiming high this year and have started our influenza vaccine campaign. Our team in employee health is having clinics regularly. They are putting on their flu fairy wings and visiting departments. And then our healthcare teams who have nurses and a place to store vaccines are also able to provide them in the department. So we're trying to make it as accessible as possible for our providers to get their vaccinations along with their COVID boosters. And then lastly, our antimicrobial stewardship. There are seven elements to meeting sort of all of the core recommendations from the CDC, and Jefferson Healthcare is at 100%. You can see that compares with 83% across Washington and 89% nationally. Any questions before we leave this slide? Commissioner Dressler, I think there you are. Yeah.
That my husband had to, he had a clinic visit with his provider, and at that time he got his flu in one arm and his COVID booster in the other arm at that visit. So that was very encouraging that they've got them in the clinics for us, our patients.
Absolutely. We are strongly encouraging our patients as well as our healthcare providers to get those COVID boosters as well as their influenza vaccine. So, and partnering with the health department to do that as well. So thanks to the health department and to our partners in the medical group for really making every effort. They did a weekend clinic not too long ago and just really trying to find ways to provide that service to the community.
Thank you.
Brandy?
Yes.
Obviously, all of these percentage statistics have are determined in part by the size of the denominator. And I'm curious where do we rank in terms of overall size of community access critical access hospitals? Like, are we in the top 10% largest, or are we in the middle, or where are we?
That's a great question. I don't have the data in front of me. I can say anecdotally from working with my quality colleagues across the state, we are one of the largest. Mason is also a larger critical access hospital, and Kittitas is another one. But I would definitely say, and Mike's bubble just lit up, but I would put us in the top five.
And is that true across the country as well, that we're in the top 5% of sizes?
I would need to look at the data to confirm that, but my experience is we are definitely a larger than normal critical access hospital.
Thank you.
I have never seen a Puget Sound Business Journal list of largest critical access hospitals, but I believe by virtue of revenue, we're the largest critical access hospital. We have more revenue than those other large facilities that Brandy mentioned. So I think that's the case.
Thank you.
All right, next slide, please. And additionally, one of the components that we look at is how well we're reporting information to the next level of care for the patients who are being transferred out of the emergency department. We know that patient handoffs can be problematic, and that one of the most at-risk moments for patients is when they're transitioning from one area to another. And so this is a really important process measure that we look at. And this is based on the sampling of records that we look at every month. So we look at about 45 records, and we look at all of these, mostly our composite score. So you can see here that our composite score is at 100%. That actually has been true for the last 4 quarters. So the emergency department does a great job of ensuring that we're communicating to the next level of care for those patients. And then how that compares to the state is at 88% and nationally at 90%. So nice job there. Next slide. All right. One of our other quality tactics is to design the most effective performance improvement system. And I just wanted to take a moment to thank and appreciate all of our leaders who spent the entire day on October 4th working on writing SMART goals and really learning more about alignment from department goals to the strategic goals and diving into that work. So that's work we're going to continue to do. And I just wanted to take a moment and tie it back to our overarching goal here and just share that there's a lot of good work happening there to cascade those strategic goals down to the department level. Next slide. All right. And we always like to make sure that we're capturing the words of our patients before we close out. So one of our service goals is to provide the best patient experience that we can. And so here we have our inpatient satisfaction data. And you can see we had quarters one and two. Our scores dipped down just a little bit. That was at the time we were seeing lots of comments about crowding, about COVID, reduced visitors, that kind of thing that were really impacting our service scores. And it's, I'm happy to share that that has popped back up again. So third quarter looks really good. Fourth quarter has started, but we certainly don't have enough to give a good sample size. So we don't have that on here just yet. But a few phrases and feedback items from our patients here. Next slide. And that's all I've got. Any questions?
No questions? Any questions? Okay, Brandy, nice report. Very uplifting. Thank you. And
everybody.
Yes. Okay, then we will move on again to Chief Financial Officer Tyler Freeman, who's back from the future to the present.
Right, more numbers, just what everyone wanted. Next slide. So 2022, September, looking at, you know, current year, we ended up in a little bit of a mixed bag for September, but as you'll see on the next slide, gross patient revenue was actually up 1%. We've been lower than our revenue targets throughout the year, so getting back to 1% above budget was good for the month, but you can see there's still some departments that are lagging behind. Some of these are still staffing related issues, you know, for departments that are very staff driven of the volumes there, just need the people. If we're down on some of the positions that we need, we're just not going to see those volumes tick back up quite yet. But overall, not a bad place to be with adjusted patient days being 1% over budget. That's our big indicator for the outpatient side of the world, and patient days being 8% over budget. And then you can see the various clinics and in areas down below. Next slide. So as I said, September ended up 1% over budget for gross patient revenue. We are pretty much right at budget for total operating revenue. We're still posting that about $240,000 of deferred revenue from CARES Act last year. But our other revenue budget is actually pretty close, just because we've seen a big dip in our 340B revenue. And that's been something we've been keeping an eye on, and it's not something where we're an outlier. Other critical access hospitals are seeing that same dip in their 340B revenue. And I know there's a lot of legislative stuff out there and a lot of lobbying that's happening regarding 340B, some of it more PPS hospital related, but some of it that would also have an impact for critical access hospitals as well. And then on the expense side, operating expenses, salaries and wages are still below low budget. Other expenses were quite high, and if you looked at the detail, you would have seen that professional fees were really high for the month. We crested it over $1 million for professional fees, and we only budgeted about $150,000 for that. And so that's the traveler cost. It was high for the month, but we also had about $350,000 that should have been posted previously that was not accrued. And so we had some old invoices come in, should have been something that was on our radar that we had in our accounts payable, but we did not for one reason or another. And so we do have about $350,000 of other professional fees that were added. That's definitely impacting how bad that looks for this given month. But at the same time, you know, as I was saying during the budget presentation, you can go to any news source and see that that's the issue that hospitals are having right now. There are not just in the states, but, you know, if you go on Becker's, you'll see that nationally, margins are tight right now, and a lot of margins are negative, and that's mostly staffing related. A lot of premium pay, a lot of traveler expense, and so we are not alone in seeing that. But we did have by posting some old invoices in for this month, and just having more than we expected, we kind of had the double whammy for the month of September. But overall, even with the net loss for the month, if you go over to the year-to-date number, we're at 3.2 million change in net position year-to-date, budgeted for 2.9, and we were right on target with where we were last year. So even though we do have those deferred CARES funds, we're still in a pretty good spot. We're at a 2.8% margin, and salaries and benefits are at 62.1% of net patient revenue. And then on the next slide, we've got our cash in accounts receivable. We wait for that to move ahead. There we go. We're sitting at about 126 days cash, and you'll see the number that we have, all the lines kind of coincide because we don't have any Medicare advanced payback to send to CMS, but we also don't have a significant payable or receivable booked for our cost report either. And that's because we just got our interim rate. And so we've just settled up with them. I believe it was about $1 million payment to CMS, and that's why the number dropped a little bit for total days cash. Nothing really to note other than that. Next slide. Board report. This is pretty consistent as it's been all year. We see the big differences are the audit fees, as those are being accrued throughout the month, and then the election expenses that didn't make it into the 2022 budget. So nothing really to note there. Next slide. October, as of this morning, we are sitting at about 98.8% of budget. Pretty close. You can see only $10,000 a day less in charges than what our budget was. Cash collections down a little bit from where we budgeted, but not too far off pace. And days in AR at 44.3 days, under the 45 that we're shooting for. So October's shaping up to be probably pretty consistent with September, and as long as the traveler fees don't come and bite us, and we don't have anything that wasn't accrued for, we should be in pretty good shape.
Sounds good. Any questions for Tyler? Okay, you must have been very thorough. There are no questions.
Everyone's numbered out.
I think so. Thanks, Tyler.
Thanks.
Mike, anything that you'd like to add?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, then you can segue right into your administrative report.
All right.
Looking forward to that. Thank you, Mike. Great.
You bet. I think we will start with Dunya giving us an advocacy report. Is that right? Yeah, Dunya, take it away.
Got it. Thanks. So on the state side for advocacy, we made front page news in the PDN for our legislative visit with Representatives Therringer and Chapman. So again, that was a really exciting event that we had last month to talk about our campus expansion modernization project and also our expansion of the OBGYN clinic in their space. In the last month, we've also submitted a capital budget request to Governor Inslee's office via the OFM. And that focuses again on the Jefferson Reproductive and Gynecological Health Project. It includes for the new building, the OBGYN clinic component of the new building, and also one third of the surgery suite in the outpatient surgery center. The total cost of that entire project is estimated to be around $10 million, and so we put in a request for $4 million. The governor's budget is what the legislature starts with during their session, is almost like these are the governor's priorities, and moves forward with it from there. And so we will submit this to Governor Inslee, and then we will also submit a request through Representative Therringer. So this is not a must get, but it's a really nice to have. And I think that, yeah, I feel really good about our application. I think it's a strong application. So that was exciting. I'll keep everyone updated on that. Next slide, please. And then on the federal side, we had a site visit from Colleen Miner. She's the director for the Kitsap and Olympic Peninsulas for Senator Murray, which was great. We did a tour of our building, including the oncology clinic, which we are in the Senate appropriations budget on the federal side, but it's always good to have Senator Murray also pushing and enthused about this kind of work. We talked a lot about our workforce challenges, and we talked about just overall rural healthcare, which was a great visit. First time she's been out here. So that was an exciting piece. She's also going to connect us to some of her grant writing staff that are in Senator Murray's office to help us identify additional funds. We're continuing to follow up with staff from all three offices around our appropriations asks for the federal side of things for the Linear Accelerator. No news so far. I'm anticipating that we will have a final federal budget December. I'm hoping it'll definitely be after the election. So I'll keep everyone in the loop around that. And we are continuing to partner with Representative Kilmer's office and WISHA staff, actually, to look at that critical access hospital reimbursement policy. If you remember from last month and from previous months, this is looking at Critical Access Hospital Modernization Act, so including more services under a critical access hospital payment methodology. So we are not getting dinged on the financial side for providing things like skilled nursing, home health and hospice, ambulance services, some of these non-covered critical access hospital cost-based services. And they have designed that overview of looking at a demonstration project specifically around specialty behavioral health care. So we are continuing to work with their office around that. And so most likely they will introduce it this session. If it looks good, with the anticipation that it won't get any traction until next session because everything is so busy with the election and recesses and all of that. So we're still working hard on that piece. Mike, anything to add?
Nope.
Awesome. And then I think I was going to do an update on the ACO. Do you want me to do that now or later?
Yeah, I think now would be a great time. We're going to try to provide snapshots of, one part, just education on value-based purchasing, value-based healthcare, and accountable care organizations. And also one part, an update on our work. Those areas. And we thought we would just include them as part of DUNIA's advocacy reports. So this is in response, I think, to what one, it's just a good idea because this is work that we are doing and you will be seeing more of in the next few board meetings. And secondly, there's the level of community interest in this work and healthcare payment methodology as well. So go ahead, Dunya.
Thanks. And Tyler is also on here and he is a technical expert in this field. So if I have questions, I will pass them off to him. Next slide, please, Brittany. So for value-based purchasing, the way I think about it is based on different payers. So for Medicare, there's actually more than two options. There's a whole bunch of different options, but the two big options that I always think about are an ACO, which for us, whenever we talk about an ACO, it's the Medicare Shared Savings Program, MSSP. There's a ton of different models that have come out of CMS and out of CMMI, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation. But let's focus on the MSSP piece as an ACO, or there's MIPS. And if you do not do an advanced payment model, such as an ACO, you are required to do MIPS. For Medicaid, we have MCO-specific contracts, and we currently participate in some of those. And that really looks at our population under a specific payer. And so this is not all of Medicaid. It is Amerigroup only or Molina only or United only. So it's very specific to that payer population. And then also in the state of Washington, we've had this transformation project that's been going on for about the last 6 years that came from the federal government, a chunk of funding to try to transform health and healthcare in our state. And we've been a part of that, which is the Olympic Community of Health, which we presented on in the past for many years now and are continuing to work on that. On the private payer side, there are potential for payer-specific contracts, although we currently don't have any of those. So that's sort of a really high-level overview of value-based purchasing and the way that I sort of bucket it. I'm sure anyone who works in this field has different buckets, but those are the ones that make the most sense to me and the ones that I kind of place our transformation work underneath. Next slide, please, Brittany. So an accountable care organization, which is what we're going to focus on a little bit today, is this is from CMS. It's a group of doctors, hospitals, and other healthcare providers who come together voluntarily to give coordinated high-quality care to their Medicare patients. And so it's really looking at a patient population as a population instead of as an individual that is sitting in front of one of the providers or even their family if they're sitting in front of our family practice providers. It's looking at an entire group of people and how do I track my entire panel or my entire population. So it's really rooted in a lot of quality and looking at that as an entire group. Next slide, please. Some of the tenets are to improve the health of the population, as I said, to improve the patient experience with, in this case, our healthcare system, to improve clinician experiences and reduce provider burnout, and to lower cost. And so this is known as the quadruple aim. Yeah.
Right. And I guess I will chime in at this point. This is why. This is our North Star for pursuing really any other model, clinical model, delivery model, payer model. This is the direction that we want to move our healthcare system, and that there are methodologies out there that deliver on this. So I think the answer to the question that you may get in the community, boy, I heard Jefferson Healthcare is interested in an ACO. Why would you do that? It's this. It's to improve the health population, improve patient experience, improve clinic experience, and to lower costs. Now, there's all sorts of nuances and complications and twists and turns in the path to get there. But I think the simple elevator speech is we are interested in these four tenets, and the group of people that are doing this work, administrators, providers, and now even members of the community, we are focused on this. So I think that I just wanted to make that point, because when I saw this slide, I thought we probably don't talk about why we are doing this enough. It's not some kind of shiny new reimbursement toy that has attracted our attention. We really believe that it will deliver on the four aims and position our community and the healthcare delivery system to overperform.
Thanks, Mike. Next slide, please, Brittany. So Jefferson has been involved in an ACO in the past. If you remember, in 2016, we began participating in the Rocky Mountain ACO, the RMACO, and that was a group of rural hospitals, some of which were in Washington State and some were in Colorado, and sort of the basis of the infrastructure and the administrative oversight was based out of Grand Junction, Colorado. So we started that in 2016. It was a three-year program that we participated in. And it ended in 2018, and it really led us to do a lot of work around our clinical pieces and understanding how our care coordination team would work and what types of patients that they would focus on. Did we need only nurses? Should we also have community health workers to help navigate folks through our system and other systems as well? We also did a ton of learning around data, which is a lot of my first job whenever I started here, was understanding all of the data pieces that we were getting from Medicare around our patient population that was attributed to us. And so it was a great three-year learning piece. And then we took a pause. We wanted to sort of think really intentionally about where we moved forward with this kind of program that we were looking at. And so, as I said, if you did not participate in an advanced payment model, such as an ACO, you are required to do MIPS, the Merit-Based Incentive Payment System. And so we've been doing MIPS for the last 3 years, 19, 20, 21, 4 years, 22, and we'll report in 23 for performance year 22 in February. And it is focused a lot on the same things. It's focused on looking at cost of your population. It's focused on your quality scores. And so we submit an incredible amount of data around our quality scores. So a huge thank you to the data team, especially Sean Downing, for leading all of that every year. which essentially have to dust off our how do we report to MIPS once a year handbook to make sure that we're doing it accurately. It also looks at the way that we use our electronic healthcare system, so Epic. And so are we having electronic referrals sent to places? Can they get those electronic referrals? All of these things that make a really comprehensive healthcare system work for patients and for providers. That's what MIPS is looking at. And it is really, it's not an option. We are required to report. We are required to participate. So we've been doing that for a couple of years now. And I think that we're quite good at it. Actually, we have really high quality scores. We have really solid data systems. We work to know every bonus that we could potentially get for MIPS. But MIPS is very prescriptive. And it doesn't really sort of speak to our innovative nature here at Jefferson Healthcare. So in 2021, we looked at participation in a new ACO. And that was a group that we were talking to down in Southwest Washington, Physicians of Southwest Washington, PSW. It wasn't a good fit for our community and our workforce and our culture. And so we decided to put a pause on that. So we just had a few conversations with them. Didn't really think that that would be the best use of our time. And so we paused it and did another year of MIPS. However, over this last year, we've started to explore what it would take to stand up our own ACO. This would be run by Jefferson Healthcare for Jefferson County and Jefferson County residents. There would not be an administrative oversight located in Grand Junction or in Southwest Washington. It would be located here. So that's something that we have been looking at pretty closely. Next slide, please, Brittany. So, as I said, administratively based at Jefferson Healthcare, it would only, to begin with, include roughly 8,000 to 9,000 Jefferson Medicare lives. And so that's what they anticipate our population would look like, which is, it's not bad. The minimum to start an ACO is 5,000 lives. The more lives you get, the less likely you are to be cursed by small numbers. And so you often want a little bit more, but 8,000 to 9,000 is actually quite good for just being a single ACO. In that Rocky Mountain ACO experience, we had the highest number of lives here. We were the biggest agency that participated in that. Again, the model is a Medicare Shared Savings Program. Because we would be a new ACO, we'd be upside only, so there's no downside financial risk. This model's been at CMS for over a decade. It's often run by providers themselves for their patient population, and so it is very homegrown and focused on the population that we are talking about and that we are specific to. Some of the benefits is that, again, it focuses on the population. We get additional data to understand areas where we could potentially do better. And we would get the potential savings that would lead to reinvesting in ourselves, such as more robust care coordination model, doing some more work around care gap closure, things like that. It would be all internal that we'd be able to manage. I had to include some of the downfalls in here because it's going to be, I think, a really big lift. And I think we're all very excited about it. But it's a ton of work to stand something like this up. However, I think that we are ready and we've been talking about this for a really long time. We have very dedicated folks at the SLG level and also some of our physician leaders. So Dr. Mattern especially has been very interested in this and is going to be really driving some of our clinical, all of our clinical model, most likely. Next slide, please. So some of the next steps is, as Mike said, we would like to make this a monthly update. So we have transparency to the board and our community around the things that we are working with. We have started some of the processes for a 2023 ACO. Mike in the future will be running some documents by you for some of that review. And really my focus right now is on standing up the board as well as Tyler, who's been integral to all of this. One of the members must be a non-Jefferson Healthcare professionally affiliated person who's a Medicare fee-for-service patient. He's going to help. So that person will help keep us accountable. It'll help bring that patient lens to conversations. And it'll really support our community engagement and communication piece, which I'm very excited about. So standing up that board is sort of the next big task on my list and making sure that everyone is involved and understands sort of the focus. Mike, what I miss?
That's great.
Awesome. What questions are there?
I'd like to ask a quick question about the possibility of our somehow promoting in our community that people choose traditional Medicare so that they can be part of our specific program. The literature, the media are full of the problems that are caused by Medicare Advantage programs, and I won't begin to mention all of them. But I was disturbed when I went to Safeway the other day that inside the Safeway store, there was a private insurance person who was a sales manager trying to promote Medicare Advantage programs inside the Safeway store. And that really bothered me. I talked to the Safeway manager, and he said that Safeway has this agreement with, I think it's with, what's the large local insurer, Advantage insurer?
Humana?
United or Regions?
Humana?
No, the one that provides managed care options for people here in this county. Anyway, and he said, yeah, Safeway has an arrangement with them. However, that doesn't mean that he personally couldn't make a change and is open to that. But anyway, I'll leave it at that. And I'd love to have a conversation with some of the staff about what we can do to prevent people from being scooped up into Medicare managed programs that have been shown to not be good for patients and dramatically increase the cost of healthcare in this country.
Yeah, I think, Case, that sort of illuminates why we are doing this, because the world around us is changing. The reimbursement landscape is changing, and it's going to change. And it's usually small rural hospitals are bystanders to that. And, you know, you just look for the car that zips by you that you can jump in and go where it takes you. This really is an opportunity to find the right program, find the right partners, and develop a clinical and a reimbursement model that works best for our community. So sure, there's some risk in that, and there's a degree of work, but we are as uncomfortable as you were seeing that that booth. We are uncomfortable just kind of waiting around and seeing what develops. But the key is just going to be, you know, charting the best path, and we're pretty keen on doing so.
I think that's awesome.
Okay. And while you know, we try and direct folks to Sheba that do have questions on Medicare coverage, so they can get that unbiased opinion of what would work best for them. But if we were to create a Medicare ACO, part of those requirements does include, you know, signage within the clinics to say that we are part of it, communications that would happen with the patient. So while we wouldn't necessarily be, you know, promoting to stay in traditional Medicare versus Medicare Advantage, we would be giving them the education that we are part of this, and this is what it means to you as a patient.
Well, I'm interested to hear more about it and understand the ins and outs and how it's funded and that sort of thing.
You're going to get monthly snapshots.
All right. Great.
Thank you. Maybe that could be an education topic on some future date.
Yes.
I think that's great, because I think we as a board might well take a role in helping educate our constituents in a way that is fitting and appropriate.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yep. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dunia.
Thank you, Dunia.
So we'll just kind of flow through our volumes at the same sort of choppy near budget performance in primary care and specialty clinic. Next slide. Same and true with oncology infusion. Some really exciting things happening in oncology infusion with respect to provider recruitment. We've recruited two new APPs that are really excited about coming here and continue to identify the right size of oncologists for the expanding program as well. And surgery continues to grow as is shown in that chart. Next slide. And in the emergency department and Express Clinic, particularly Express Clinic, continues to be busy. Next slide. Oh, and I think this is by county. Yes, by county.
This is PCP status. Sorry, Mike.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we would have to toggle that measure on the left.
Okay. But we are predominantly seeing Jefferson or most of the patients have Jefferson Healthcare providers. Next slide.
This one's by county.
Okay. We were watching the growth in Clallam earlier, and you saw 1 week it popped up to almost a quarter of our services. And frankly, we've been watching a little bit in the for Kitsap County in the last couple of weeks, and it doesn't really look like that spiked up too much. Next slide. Okay, this is an update. I think I am, per board policy, required to present to you capital items that are in the capital budget but cost over $100,000 that for your review. And we are buying a monitoring system for upstairs, and it's a big deal, long in the works, and I believe the installation is beginning.
Great.
Next slide.
Can I ask you what sort of monitoring system it is, Mike? Please?
It's a Philips product. Tina, do you want to speak more to it?
It's our telemetry monitoring system that we use throughout the ACU and ICU.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I just wasn't sure what we were monitoring. Thank you.
Thanks for asking, Maury.
Well, inquiring minds need to know.
For $400,000, we better be monitoring a hell of a lot. We're buying $400,000 worth of monitoring. So
we better be watching the monitors.
Yeah.
Whether it's marine or medical, the two M's are highly expensive.
Okay. Thanks, Tina. Next slide. All right.
Do we need a motion to adopt that, or is that just?
I just think I need to run it by you. I don't think I need a motion. It's approved by the board when we approve 2022's capital budget. But just because there are some big purchases in there, the board said it would please. It's a responsibility of mine, not a auditor responsibility to get approval. But just when you buy big things, let us know.
Yeah,
it's enough by eye.
Yeah.
Thank you.
More to the point, it's when you're spending big money, we need to know.
Yeah, true. All right. Well, as you have been, no doubt been following in the newspaper and I think some emails that I have shared with some of you, and I think all of you, we continue to participate in identifying and landing a expansion of quality childcare solution in our community. And Molly's been in front of you several times for several different topics, but I think have given you update over the years on childcare, and there are some really exciting things happening. And I asked her if she could give a brief update tonight and a deeper update either in November or December. And she was kind enough to agree to do so. So Molly, take it
over. Yeah, I'm delighted to be here. It's nice to have some exciting news to share in the progress. I think we've been working on this since 2016 with the first employee survey. And I think I presented to you with the Pop Health team first in 2018 in January. So it's been years of working on this. Jefferson Healthcare has worked in the role of gathering partners together and working on solutions for childcare, primarily around three aspects. One is finding an operator for childcare. Another is finding funding for the childcare because the business model is so difficult. And the other was finding a site for the childcare. And so the partners that we've been working with, you're all familiar with, the YMCA with Wendy Bart, Peninsula College, the county, especially Kate Dean, the city with John Morrow and Carrie Height, the schools, both Chimicum and Port Townsend, with Scott Mock and Linda Rosenberry. And we've been working with STL Studios as well as we look at feasibility studies and sites. You'll remember the, I think, 48-page Caring for Our Future report that we created, looking at a needs assessment, et cetera. And in that, we started identifying what we were looking for in an operator and a site. For an operator, earlier this spring, we asked for letters of intent, and we were able to select from those the YMCA as an operator for the childcare. So that has been one major hurdle that we have overcome. It's really exciting to work with them. The next hurdle has been the site. We've been looking for a place for this for a long time. You'll remember a feasibility study from last year that looked at three sites. We outlined over 15 different sites in that process. We made an offer on a site that then sold to somebody else. And once that sold, we started expanding again, looking for another site for childcare. We asked the community and primarily the public entities, including the schools, the county, and the city, to see if they had any spaces that could be used for childcare. And in June, the Port Townsend School District evaluated their sites and found a parcel of land next to the tennis courts at the high school that they did not have included in their master plan that was being sparsely used. And they thought that that might be a good place for a childcare right on the school campus. So this was really exciting. This was in June. In July, the school board had a meeting and presented it. We did a feasibility study similar to the others that we conducted. There was a CAM done with the city to look at this space. It was discussed again at the August and September school board meetings. In October, we had a community visioning meeting for folks to come and give input. And then last Thursday on October 20th, the school board voted to surplus that land and approve a lease with the YMCA for that land for a nominal fee. So it's just really exciting. The process has been long for us. For the school, it's been through this summer. And that process has brought forward many different opinions and ideas. It's been really exciting. The process has worked for most people. Some people are still discouraged about it, but I want to speak a little bit to next steps with this space. But first of all, it's just really exciting, and you all should be really proud. So next steps, the lease needs to be advertised in the Port Townsend Leader for 45 days, after which then the superintendent is able to sign that lease. But we are far from done. Obviously, that's just a site of land. The next steps really on our role will change a bit. We'll be in more of a supportive advocacy role, looking for funding, and again, working with our partners on that funding. The why will probably start project management and look at design and cost estimates, and that will help the funding search as well. We'll have to go through permitting and really detailed design. And as a part of that, there will be traffic studies, et cetera. And depending on who manages this whole project, who the Y chooses, I anticipate there being opportunity for community input around the specific design of the building and the structure and the parking lots, et cetera, because we really do want to minimize the impact to the surrounding neighborhood and augment the impact for the school. The high school principal is extremely excited about this as an opportunity for the high school students to participate and get a sense of early childhood education. So working with the school as well to make sure that it fits right in. So what you can anticipate is more advocacy from our end for our employees and for our community. I anticipate potential MOUs with the Y as we talk about how can we formalize the benefit for our employees in particular. And then I just wanted to thank you for your support for all of these years of work. This is a milestone. It's not done yet. And your support is really appreciated coming forward. I think one of the voices that spoke out during the public comment at all of these meetings, there were at least four opportunities for public comment, was a young mother who had her baby in tow and just was expressed a lot of frustration about feeling invisible in this community and feeling like the services were just not there to support a growing family community. And I think that's our job at this point as leaders and community members, is really to be that voice for all of our community and the needs of families. So I really appreciate, I know you work with the public a lot, and so your voice is in support is really appreciated. So I also wanted to throw out a huge thanks to Linda Rosenberry at the school. I think this has been a huge lift for her at a time when she has the priority of teaching our kids. So I just really appreciate her taking that time out of her other jobs to do this work. So I'm open to questions, but I think I'll also be back to another board meeting in the future for other questions.
Any questions, Mari?
Yeah, well, two things, Dr. Parker. First of all, this has been an ongoing issue for the 40 years I've lived here and worked at Jefferson Healthcare, because childcare was no easier back in those days. So I think all your efforts and the partners that you've been working with, absolutely sterling accomplishments. So I'm all in. My son is, you know, nearly 30 and growing out of the community, but it was a nightmare when I was working as a nurse. And secondly, I think the fact that there's a possibility for high school students to be somehow involved. I have a nephew who's actually just turned 50, and one of his sons, my great nephew, both of them work in childcare in Germany. My nephew runs a childcare early learning center in a village outside of Stuttgart, and his son has gone into the same business, and it's a local government run, both of them are local government run entities. But a part of my great nephew's senior year was a 3-month experience in childcare. I mean, he had various options, but he thought he wanted to try the childcare route, and he liked it so much that he signed up to do the 2-year program to become able to work in childcare. So I think if there's an opportunity to help our high school students get a feel for some sort of work program, because it's a 3-month program in this area in Stuttgart, that it just gives them a sense of, you know, going to work every day and seeing what they want to do. And there's an opportunity for us maybe to get involved in the similar program. I think it's excellent. So I can't thank you enough for all your hard work and the partners you're working with. So thank you so much.
Thanks. Yeah, we're excited.
If I might.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'd also like to mention that that change is difficult for some people in communities. It's always difficult to see changes. And I've forwarded to Mike and Molly and others a few concerns that neighbors there have had about traffic and whatnot. And I'm happy to see or hear you say, Molly, that there is a commitment to continue to look at how this can best be integrated into the neighborhood so that that the school is a good partner with the neighbors. And also that I might mention that I have heard from the architect who's helping or the contractor who's helping with this project that he and the city are moving forward with an official traffic study, which I think will help explain how the traffic patterns are going to work and hopefully will help reassure the neighbors that this project will not have a significant negative impact on the neighborhood. So thank you for being open to that.
Of course, and that will be part of the design process, and it is actually required by the city to have a traffic study, so there's no question that it will be done.
Right.
Well, Molly, I think Dr. Parker, thank you so much for all the work that you put into this on top of your excellent work as a physician for us. You're just a community gem. And thank you. Thank you. And I hear all kinds of wonderful comments about this. I can't remember when there's been more excitement in the community for something. So thank you.
So good to hear.
All right, and you'll get another presentation and update in either November or December on this work and some of the other population health initiatives. At the end of a board meeting, might have been the last one or the one before, I think Case asked about our role in this project, and if you look at this project through the lens of who the major players are structurally, it's the school district because they own the property and will hold the land lease. The county, because they've made application for the grant and will be funneling those dollars to build the facility, and the YMCA, because they will be holding the license to operate this. So my answer was sort of framed looking through that lens and said we weren't one of the main players. But that while that was accurate looking through that particular lens, it was inaccurate in that what's very clear is that the role Molly is playing is coordinator, catalyst, and manager of this whole process. So I think it's fair to say if Molly weren't in that role, all of this wouldn't be happening. So clearly we are a major player in this as well. And also we have made successful application for several grants for the purpose of funding design. And some of those dollars are flowing through Jefferson Healthcare and paying for the design team for this work. So we are involved in that respect too. And I suspect at some point there will be memorandums of understanding that I will put in front of you that formalizes an ongoing relationship with the center, hopefully to the benefit of both the center and Jefferson Healthcare employees. Again, more in a month or two, and thanks for your work, Molly.
If I may, Mr. President, I would like to reiterate that, because during the 40 years I said that I've been here, and many attempts have been suggested and sort of percolated through the community and through the hospital trying to do something about childcare for our predominantly female staff employees. This is no doubt being very well managed, directed, herded, or whatever term you want to put on it, by Dr. Parker. And I cannot thank her enough and her cohorts who are doing this and partnering with those people who they're partnering with now, I think is absolutely terrific. And my one last question is, what sort of capacity do you think it will have, Dr. Parker?
So it's designed to hold about 40 kids, with hopefully 8 of them being infants. And interestingly, the Y is also the operator for the childcare that will open up next to QFC that will be predominantly preschool, so 3 to 5 year olds. So a total of about 60 kids of new capacity in the community.
Fabulous. Thank you so very much. Thank you.
That's a good start. We're going to keep pushing at this. Okay. All right. Thank you, Molly. So a quick CHRO update, kind of a comings and goings. I think if you've been in the organization in the last week or so, you likely saw Heather. Heather Bailey is back. There she is, as the interim CHRO, and she will be fulfilling that role, and she will also be helping out in sort of a consultative nature as well. When she was doing work in Arizona for a large hospital chain, not only was she responsible for human resources in her hospitals, but they sent her to other hospitals and asked her to sort of comment on structure and policy and the like. So we plan to squeeze as much value out of Heather as we possibly can get from her in the time that she's here. And the goings is Allison Crispin. This will be Allison's last board meeting. And I don't see her on the list, but I think Allison is leaving in a week or two, resigning from Jefferson Healthcare and actually leaving the community. And we wish the best for her. She's been a great partner and continued to move the work in human resources along. And we are all sorry to see her go, but it's for good and exciting and happy reasons. So I wanted to announce those two comings and goings.
That's nice. Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate it. And the timing really worked out for both Mike and I. It was crazy. She, had just given her notice, and I reached out to Mike 48 hours later, said, listen, I'm going to be doing some consulting. He's like, you've got to be kidding me. So here I am. I will say Allison has been a great partner over the last 7 days. She will exit on the 4th, and then I'll officially take the helm on the 5th. So I am kind of finding my way around the new layout and getting to know the new faces. It's really been awesome. As I said to Mike, everything has changed. And then nothing has changed, right? It's a really cool kind of paradigm to see how much you have all accomplished in 7 years that I've been away. So the HR team, just to give you a quickie update, we have filled almost all of our positions. So there's a full complement of talent acquisition. That's our recruiting team. You'll hear me refer to them as TA, talent acquisition. And we have one position open. We're going to be looking for a compensation and benefits professional, but that's really the only opening that we have. So right now I'm starting to pull the group together, begin to socialize certain ideas around HR construct, around the, professionalizing the function and how we can best optimize performance in the organization. So lots to come. Hope to get a lot accomplished, and we're going to come right out of the gate with some leadership development and really tap into those new green leaders that we have. So super excited. Just happy to be here with all of you. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Well, welcome, Heather. Welcome back. And thank you. And to Allison, best wishes for your future.
I will pass it on.
Yeah.
All right. And then I just wanted to present that we spoke last board meeting. I think it was last board meeting for sort of like the scattershot of public presentations on issues, including the strategic plan. And I thought I had shared those at that meeting, but I didn't. So since most of them are out in front of us, I wanted to give you the dates. During this meeting, We were in Ludlow on Monday, and Bruce and Mari joined us, and a couple of other Jefferson Healthcare employees and members from the press and a hospital administrator I worked with a bunch of years ago who had relocated to Ludlow, and a few other folks. And that was mostly just sort of a catch up on what's happening at Jefferson Healthcare with a focus at the end on Port Ludlow. This Friday, it will be the first strategic plan listening session, and we're going to do this virtually for an hour in the mid morning, where we'll kind of go over the strategic plan and seek feedback. And then we're going to do that again on November 7th, where I'll go over the strategic plan and seek feedback. Excuse me. Then the board first bounce will be November 16th for the strategic plan that we're going to ask you to comment on. And then the second bounce will be at the December meeting, where if we're ready and everyone's comfortable, I'll ask for your approval. So you never know what you're going to get with these presentations. We are trying different times of the day because the 5 to 6 or 6 to times we've used in the past hasn't really brought a lot of people online. Maybe these different times will, but in any event, the community will have lots of opportunities to engage and provide input over the next month or so. And given it's past 5:30 and you've been listening to administration for 3.5 hours, I will conclude my presentation and certainly answer any questions.
Thank you, Mike. This is a good presentation. Any questions? Okay. Well, thank you for. How can we thank you? You're the one that holds everything together and figures everything out. So any thanks we give anybody here goes to you too.
I remind my team of that frequently.
All right. Okay, then we are on to board business and Board of Health. Case, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yes, first of all, I sent you all a report of what I reported to the Board of Health last week from what we are doing. And I also included a list of the topics that are top of the list for the Department of Health here. And I just wanted to mention two or three things. One is that actively interviewing potential CHIP program managers. I think we're all excited to see the CHIP program begin to get up and running again, particularly since we are due for another community health assessment. Obviously, the manager of CHIP will play a big role in that. The other thing is that we continue to lead the state in how well we are tracking our COVID patients in this community. We have a 40% case ascertainment rate in Jefferson County compared to a 7% average in the state. And it's just because of the way this community has rallied behind reporting their home testing positive COVID tests, and the way our public health department here is just really on top of things. And then finally, three of us on the Board of Health, or two of us, Kate Dean and myself, and then Apple Martin, the director, and Michael Dawson, one of the staff people, have presented a plan to the Board of Health and have been encouraged to implement that starting in January to do a fairly long, we don't know how many months, in-depth education of the Board of Health regarding the climate crisis, and with particular focus on what would be appropriate for a Board of Health to get involved, since obviously the climate changes that are occurring, whether it's the smoke problems, whether it's potential fires, whether it's the heat, have impacts on human health. And so the question is, what role will the can the health department have here locally to help support the community in adapting to the inevitable changes? And I'll keep you posted on that. And that's all I've got.
Thank you. That sounds interesting. That's a big chunk to chew.
Yep. It's going to be a very important topic, and I think it's going to take an increasing prominence in our community as well as the rest of the state, not to mention the country and the world.
Yep. Okay. All right, then, any questions for Case? Okay, then the independent auditor, the board every year appoints an independent auditor who is paid for by the board and acts on behalf of our board. And for the past 2 years, we've been very satisfied with the firm of Dingus, Zacor and Associates, a certified public accounting firm from Spokane Valley that specializes in critical access hospitals. So do any of you have any comments or questions regarding them? DZA, for short. Mari, you muted.
Yeah, I know. I moved to reappoint them, DZA,
for the next
fiscal year.
I'll second that, in that their reports have been very well done, and I have all the confidence in the world in what they do.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Okay. All in favor, raise your hand.
Aye.
Okay. That is unanimous. They are now appointed. So event agenda evaluation, it's time for a periodic agenda evaluation. How do you think the meetings are working for you? Do you think you're getting enough information? Is there information you'd rather see? Not enough? What do you think?
We can go on all night. If you need.
I know.
If you want more.
I'll bring some coffee ice cream to keep us going.
As long as Aaron fixes dinner for us when we get back to... that'd be worth it. So do anyone have any comments?
Sure, I'll start off this time if you don't mind. Is it enough information? It's obviously always more information than we can actually handle, but we have to. And so it's our responsibility to take it, to take what we need to take in order to stay current. And so once again, I just really the efficiency of the reports, I mean, are just incredible. I just can't believe how much this staff under Mike's leadership gets accomplished. And, you know, the reports show that. So, no, it's great information and very well presented.
Okay. Who else? Who's next? Okay, Matt. You're the next one on my screen there.
Yeah, I think I can't think of any major gaps. It's a lot of information in these meetings, but it's well done, well presented.
Yeah. Okay, Bruce.
Well, I agree with what Matt and Case have said. It's good to have the packet ahead because sometimes you come to these meetings and it's like drinking from a fire hose. So there's a lot of information, but it's all good.
Mari?
The gentlemen have said it all.
Okay. I can't add any more. That's great. So that made short term out of that. So the holiday meetings, due to the upcoming holidays, November's meeting has been moved to the 16th and December's to the 21st. So that, and the CEO evaluation will be coming up, so we'll be getting materials out to you sometime soon for that. Is there any other director who has any information that they want to share?
Just a quick question about the calendar. So we will not be having a meeting, any meeting on the 14th. No generative meeting this year. That's waiting until January. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. Anybody else? Mike, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
No, thank you.
I did have another question. I got something about a holiday meal on the 14th. Does anybody know anything about that? Are we serving, helping serve something to support the staff? Or
I think I'm not sure we've locked that date down.
Case, that's just a placeholder that's kind of on the calendars to keep us moving in the right direction for getting that planned. And I actually plan to connect with you about the date that we're moving that to. I did get your voicemail just before the meeting today. So I'll connect with you more details on that.
All right. Thank you.
Case, I thought you were cooking.
All right. I'll do it. Okay. Of course, I'm going to hire Aaron to help me.
That's weaseling out of a job, you know that.
Okay, time for meeting evaluation. Evaluating the meeting. Mari, you want to start?
An excellent meeting, good budget process. I cannot thank Tyler enough and his staff, all the departments that he runs. I think it was absolutely excellent. And so that's, yeah. And then glad to have Heather back and consulting with her. That's going to be a real shot on the arm for us to move forward with HR. And thanks to Alison Crispin, who's done an excellent job in various roles since she's been here. And I will miss her. And everybody else, everybody works so hard and presents so well. It was just an excellent meeting.
Okay. Case?
Well, this time the women have said it all. I'll pass.
I'm not going to comment on that. Matt?
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. It was a great meeting. Exciting stuff today, especially the childcare and the construction project.
Bruce?
Yeah, I agree with all that. I mean, Tyler's crew does a great job on the budget every year. I know what a huge job that is from some past experience. And I agree with Molly's report. That's very exciting. And the building project, I really appreciate, you know, the time they're taking to make it all fit together, not only how things are going to fit inside, but what it's going to look like. And I think after it's built, it's going to be hard to tell that it wasn't all built at the same time, mm-hmm. which is really nice.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree with everything everybody said, and I especially agree with your assessment of the architects and the construction people for, you know, the on our project, how thoughtful they are trying to making sure that all the everything's taken into consideration for patient ease to find everything and get places and all of that. I think I'm excited about it. And I'd like to, speaking of shot in the arm, Mari, be sure you all get your flu shots. Don't forget. So, you know, that's something that's coming up, needs to happen.
Well, I have to tell you that I have an appointment tomorrow for one in each arm.
Great.
Is that at Jefferson Healthcare, Mari?
No, it's at the pharmacy in Ludlow.
Yeah. I couldn't get in. Anyway, I'll try again.
At the pharmacy in Ludlow.
Oh. at our pharmacy in Ludlow.
Our pharmacy in Ludlow. Keep it in the family, Case.
I'll give it a go.
Okay. Is there a motion to conclude the meeting?
So move.
Second.
Second.
All right. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 See you next month. Thank you, everybody.
Take care.
Thanks. Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.